I can't see little blue lights.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to the interim committees. On the House side, that's the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee, and today we're meeting jointly with our Senate colleagues in the Senate Interim Veterans Committee. I just tried to make a new word there. Sorry about that. So this
no
is
worries.
Exciting. It'll be fun. So let's start with the introduction of committee members. On the House side, if we could start down on this end, and we'll see if we get a few more folks on that. Right?
Representative Judy Stigler from Bend.
Representative Chuck Riley from Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove.
Deborah Boone from the beautiful Upper Left Coast, still beautiful this week.
Representative Esquivel from Medford.
Representative Greg Matthews from House District 50, Gresham.
Good morning, I'm Tim Freeman, representative from Roseburg, South Douglas County.
And I am Representative Jean Callen. I represent the Central Oregon Coast and chair this committee. And I'm wondering if Representative Boone was there this morning, because the weather report says it's not nice anymore over there.
Well, actually, I was in Eugene this morning.
So she missed the thunderstorm.
I was there yesterday.
But it's always nice over there.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. Senator Schrader.
I am Senator Schrader from Canby, Oregon City, Gladstone, Oak Lodge, Oak Grove, and I'm the chair of the Veterans Services Committee, and I'm here with my colleague.
I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale-Wood Village, Fairview, and Representative Matthews is my representative. We're well represented today.
Your district is well represented. And I understand one of your committee members is doing...
Senator Boquist is on active duty. I did communicate with him. Evidently, there was a communication that Senator Morissette could not make it today. Is that correct? Okay. And Senator Atkinson, I'm
okay.
Wondering. We'll see.
So because of that, we have formally opened the House committee, and I would like to have an opportunity for all of us to get acquainted with our staff. The staff assignments have changed a little since the last session, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I'm Bill Taylor. I'm administrator to the House Veterans and Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. I'm also counsel to Judiciary Committee.
Right.
I'm an OBN. I'm the committee assistant for the Veterans Committee, but I'm also the office coordinator for the judiciary.
Thank you, and I think this is going to be very helpful. It'll allow us to connect some judicial and some veterans issues. That's great expertise.
We have another member joined.
Oh, excuse me. I had my head turned. And you are?
Representative Jim Widener, House District 24.
Welcome.
So, sorry I was late.
No problem. And because we officially have a quorum on the House side, we will move on to the adoption of committee rules for the House committee. And they are in your packet in front of you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I would make a motion to adopt the committee rules.
We have a motion before us to adopt the committee rules, which I think you will find very similar to all of the other committee rules that we've adopted in the past.
Look familiar.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, we will consider them adopted on unanimous vote. The work plan for this committee, for all of our committees, is also in your packet. And maybe just to briefly get an idea of what we're trying to do here today, we're trying to move through some of the bills that were passed in the last session, particularly those that assigned the development of a task force or some sort of investigational process, so that we're all up to speed on how that organization for those task forces is going and what the expectations are. Then we will take a brief break when it becomes necessary, and from the House perspective then move into the emergency services end of our discussion, a few items that we would like to talk about there. Then sort of passing the baton to the Senate side, we'll kind of move back to some additional veterans issues around reintegration, and we have an interesting presentation coming to us a little bit later this morning. What I would like the particularly the representatives from the agencies to keep in mind as we move forward, by the end of the meeting, what we'd like to be doing is talking about any possible bills that will be introduced as a committee bill in the February 2010 session, because agency efforts need to move forward through the committee bill process, as I understand it, as we're all trying to figure out exactly how we're working this. So we'd like to devote a little bit of time at the end of the meeting to a discussion of possible bills, or if any of the individual members of the committee have something in mind.
Senator, does that sort of sound as if we have it in hand, and I certainly appreciate you taking the gavel as I learn the process of chairmanship. So,
thank you for being here. Please step in at any point that something I've forgotten. With that, we will move on then to a review of some of those bills that we had last session, beginning with Senate Bill 98, which formed a task force on veterans transportation issues. Good morning, Mr. Willis.
Good morning, Chair. Chair Cowan. Chair Schrader, members of the committee, and professional staff, good morning. I'm here, as the chair just pointed out, to review three specific issues, and then I'd like to review one more that is not on the agenda. And thank goodness, because of the efficiency of the committee, I have an additional 5 minutes. So I will move right along. In the last session of the legislature, just as a review, this body passed 25 bills that pertain to veterans or their families. They passed 6 House Joint Memorials or House Joint Resolutions and 3 Senate Joint Memorials, for a total of 39 bills, memorials, or resolutions directly impacting Oregon veterans, their families, and survivors. I cannot express to this committee or these two committees how appreciative we are at our department for that strong support, and I hope you'll be pleased with some of the implementations that have occurred since that time. Beginning with Senate Bill 98, which was to establish the Task Force on Veterans Transportation to assist veterans all over our state in accessing health care. The Veterans Transportation Task Force has been formed. They come from State Employment, ODOT, Department of Human Services, the Oregon Military Department, and ODVA. In addition to that, we have ad hoc members from the Disabled American Veterans, which run the VAN program statewide, which most of you are familiar with. We have representatives from the medical transport industry. We also have representatives from Representative DeFazio's office, Senator Wyden's office. We have a representative that was asked to be put on the task force by Senator Betsy Johnson. We also have a member of the CVSO community representing their interests. And finally, we have a member from the Governor's Advisory Committee to the Department of Veterans Affairs. We expect this group will meet next month and begin their work, and then our intent is to report to the committees during the February supplemental session, or before, if we're called upon to do so, to give you an update on where that task force is in their work. I want to point out that these task forces that were created by this body through Senate Bill 98 occurred because the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services identified these as key issues that they did not have time to research in detail from March until December of 2008 when we did the work that created the task force report. In addition to that, and as a result of the passage of House Bill 2718, a task force on women's veterans health care has been created. I'm happy to tell you that one of the members of that group is the chair of the House Committee, Representative Cowan. Senator Lori Moniz Anderson is also a member, and I thank the Senator for her willingness to serve. Our newest member of the Governor's Advisory Committee to the Department of Veterans Affairs is Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Visser, United States Marine Corps retired. She has also agreed to serve on this committee. We have yet to name our women's health care provider, our mental health care provider, or the women's advocacy group provider. We have extended invitations, and we expect to get those names very shortly. Again, the Oregon Military Department will be represented on this task force, as will my agency. Department of Human Services is going to give us the name of one of their members to work with us. In addition, we have a woman veteran who recently served in Iraq and testified before these committees during the last session, Mandy Martin, who has agreed to serve, and we're happy to have Mandy with us. Asia Maloney Capps from Representative Wu's office has also agreed to serve. This committee will meet, we hope, again this next month and begin to outline their work and the outcomes that they hope to achieve. I will just touch very briefly on the reintegration task force. There is a meeting scheduled this next month, I believe it's October the 15th, at the Anderson Readiness Center of our reintegration work group here in Oregon. The members that are going to serve from this body on the task force are Representative Barton, Senator Martha Schrader, the chair of the Senate Veterans Committee. Also, we have a member from DHS, the Oregon Military Department, Employment, Housing, the Oregon University System, and we also have two veterans. One is an Iraqi veteran, recently returned, and the other is a Vietnam veteran, who have agreed to serve as ad hoc members to this committee. Again, they will begin their work next month. And again, it's our intent to report on the progress of all three of these task forces during the February session, or if called upon before. Finally, House Bill 3104 was a very broad and all-encompassing bill that had to do with veterans outreach. I'm very happy to tell you that we have made very significant progress with regard to this and some wonderful outcomes that I'm very proud of. I have some details in some written testimony that's being passed out to you, but specifically we were asked to use information technology in a way in partnership with other state agencies and later with county and municipal agencies in reaching veterans that had not been contacted in the past. As a result, the Department of Administrative Services, working with our agency and other state government agencies, has put a link on each of the agency's websites that goes directly to ODVA's website, specifically to our veterans benefits area, and has a fillable form that the veteran can fill out. We can then monitor that form and determine who is best to serve that particular veteran. In some cases, it will be a county veteran service officer. In other cases, it will be one of my service officers. And in still other cases, it could be a national service officer working for organizations such as the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Military Order, the Purple Heart, the Disabled American Veterans, and so on. To date, nearly 600 new veterans have contacted ODVA via that website link, and it only went live in July. So I'd like to think that we're going to get several hundred a month as we move along through the process. Now, in addition to that, we have worked with other state agencies to give them what we call business return cards. So this is a situation where when the veteran makes contact with another state agency such as DMV, ODFW, PUC, even the Racing Commission, believe it or not, they will be furnished with a card that they fill out and then comes back to us and allows us again to make contact with them. And in some cases, they are in line to do business with that state agency. This card allows them to fill that out while they're waiting for the service, whatever that service may be. And then when they go up to, as an example, renew a driver's license, they turn in the card and then DMV sends it to us. To date, we have printed very close to 75,000 of these cards. We know that we have a number of veterans who, for whatever reason, did not get the word about their benefits, and we know that has an impact on Oregon economically. And I just review with you that based on the number of benefits being received today by Oregon veterans, in a biennial period, there is returned in federal dollars in terms of claims, benefits, and compensation, $1.3 billion to the Oregon veterans that are in the system. We know that if we enroll more, that will have an impact indirectly on our state economy, but more importantly, we'll make sure that these veterans have received the benefits that they have coming. I also want to point out that Northwest Natural Gas included a web link in a recent end-of-month billing in a mailing with many veterans contacting our agency as a result of their natural gas bill. So we hope to work with other utilities to do that same thing, so that somehow we will reach the vast majority of eligible veterans in our state who have, to date at least, not contacted someone for their benefits. The one thing I would stress to the committee that we point out to veterans and their survivors and their families all the time is that the best way to do this is to contact a federally accredited veteran service officer. Too many times we see instances where a veteran who is in the system decides to advise a fellow veteran as to what they ought to do. And many times that advice is either insufficient or just dead wrong. So we collectively, this body and our department, have gone to a great deal of effort, along with the Association of Oregon Counties, to establish county veteran service officers throughout our state. And it's our job to provide training to them and to keep them as competent as possible with regard to these benefits. They have done that, there's no veteran who's out of reach of a county veteran service officer or a state veteran service officer in our state. So there's absolutely no excuse for anyone to seek anything less than professional and competent advice with regard to securing their benefits. The thing that I wanted to talk to you about this morning, with the committee chair's permission, is we have here with us this morning from Eastern Oregon University, Virginia Key, who is here to talk about an outreach effort that would fall under House Bill 3104 that's occurring in Eastern Oregon, where we hope to reach some additional people. And Virginia, if you would come on up, and there's a handout that comes along with Virginia's presentation. This is Virginia Key.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And if you could introduce yourself into the record as you start your
gladly. I'm Virginia Key, the Vice President for Finance Administration at Eastern Oregon University. As a result of the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services, there were some recommendations made about getting veterans into college. One of those recommendations related directly to Eastern Oregon University, and an aspirational goal of having veteran services at Eastern that range from housing, child care, career counseling, all the way through degree to help integrate veterans back in to Oregon and the rest of our country. Union County, the home of Eastern Oregon University, is a very welcoming and supportive environment for veterans. I think we've all seen throughout the nation that support for veterans can at times waver. That's not the case in Northeast Oregon. We welcome veterans no matter what our personal inclinations are towards the engagements they've been in. And right now, Eastern is the home of, on-site, about 150 veteran students. And that's a minimum. Veterans aren't required to self-disclose their veteran status, so that's a minimum. I've been working very closely with Paul Evans to see what we can do jointly to help fulfill the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force. and Eastern recently hosted a working group that Paul convened to tour Eastern's facilities, meet with the administrators, some educators, to see what we can do from there. Eastern currently has capacity for more students, both in our housing and our classrooms. Our housing, if you read the news, luckily enough, is filling up, but we do have capacity for more students, which isn't the case at every institution in the state. One needn't be a savvy consumer of higher ed to be successful at Eastern. The reason I point that out is I don't believe that many of our young veterans in particular are the type of higher education consumer that understand all the hoops and what a college education can do for them. We at Eastern specialize in taking non-traditional students and first-generation college students the next step. We may do a little more hand-holding than other institutions, but that's one of the reasons we're successful. We also offer online programs that a veteran only needs an APO box to be able to begin their education, and then we would welcome them onto campus as well if they choose to come there. That is the sum of my comments.
Chair Count.
Thank you. Senator Schrader.
Yes. If I may, I just have a few brief questions.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern William is part of the Oregon University system.
I'm sorry?
You are part of the Oregon University Correct. System. So you are developing a model for the veterans on your campus. What are, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Willis as well, across the OUS system, is there a coordinated effort to actually do these models in a systems-wide approach, or are you, doing a good job in Eastern Oregon only? I guess that's what I'm wondering about. So what's?
Well, let me come in and Virginia, please follow up. Chair Schrader, members of the committee, I look at the Eastern Oregon model as a pilot.
Okay.
And the availability of what she is talking about in terms of housing and expanded educational opportunities is going to vary from university to university across our state. But because of the emphasis on rural veterans and access, I thought, and I believe, and Paul's here, so I don't need to speak for him, but we believe that this is a very important effort that we're undertaking here, and Eastern was chosen for the pilot. I guess that's the easiest way to answer it. Paul certainly could comment in addition.
We'll get Paul up here as well to make any comments that he'd like to add.
Yeah, because the follow-up is, again, this is a pilot for rural veterans, but the whole task before us is a larger system-wide reintegration program with education, with the OUS system, as well as a community college system. Certainly, I would expect some variability within the system-wide approaches and plans, because each region has different needs, different populations, but what I'm trying to tease out is what is a statewide strategic reintegration plan with education, and indeed, is that something that's going to be looked at on October 15th as you move into this whole reintegration strategy? So, Paul, maybe you could address that.
Chairs, Cowan and Schrader. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm Governor's Policy Advisor for Veterans Issues. Two pieces. First piece is this isn't so much a reintegration program as a partnership with the Oregon Military Department. Let me explain why.
Okay.
Eastern Oregon University plays a very unique role in the education and training of the folks that comprise what they proudly call themselves the Eastern Oregon National Guard. It's a long-term relationship, and really how this started was that they're at Eastern Oregon, in fact, in concert with former education policy advisor Sager, we were sitting around trying to figure out a way to help OIT, or help Eastern Oregon. And because of the distance program that Eastern Oregon has and the ability to deliver education products while people are deployed, there was a recognition that there are some unique opportunities here. So one of the things we were looking at is using available dollars, because again, in co-location, Eastern Oregon has some things that make it a perfect pilot program, and I'll explain. There's a CBOC, literally a stone's throw from campus. CBOC is a community-based outpatient clinic that is actually through the Walla Walla system, not through the Portland system. That's an important thing. For Eastern Oregon, the Walla Walla services a lot of northeastern Oregon, whereas Portland services the Roseburg and up and down the valley pretty much. Of course, Burns and over goes through Boise. So it's not Portland. That's an important piece. The CBOC is there. There's a brand new, or at least relatively brand new, readiness center that the National Guard has. And there's 100-plus folks that come into town at least once a month that have to stay somewhere in town. And our argument is, if we could redirect some of those dollars from what's currently being paid on the economy, we could self-generate revenue to be able to provide some living spaces, or at least right. some subsidized living spaces, for military families trying to go back to school. And this all is under the idea that under the new National Guard, or the new GI Bill, it treats National Guard folks a little differently because it's based on number of months on active duty, which not every National Guard person, though mobilized once or twice, can get to the 36 months. This is the full 100% coverage. So Eastern Oregon offered us a really unique platform to try some things that are specifically designed to help the Oregon Military Department as well as veterans that may be beyond, maybe beyond the 36 months that's currently the reintegration idea. Having said that, it's not by accident that Eastern in rural Oregon and potentially Clackamas Community College in the valley can be supplemental programs. I believe Eastern Oregon already has some type of relationship with Clackamas Community in terms of delivery of programs, so it's a natural to us model. The reason we haven't done much with the Oregon University system as a whole is we're still literally trying to figure out how we can put the pieces together. It has not been done in a vacuum, however. Sager and I talked about this a number of times. The emphasis was that whatever could be done to help Eastern Oregon in terms of utilization of facilities was a good thing to pursue. And for our National Guard troops, it made a lot of sense to further secure that relationship. But please understand, it's not in lieu of a reintegration issue. It's, in fact, supplemental to it.
Yes. Thank you.
Does that help clarify?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. I do have to say that there are a number of us in this room who have some ties to that northeast corner of Oregon. I spent a number of years there, and I think Eastern is an excellent location for a pilot project like this. I'm really pleased to see the work that you're doing, so thank you for coming and telling us about it. Are there any other questions for any of these folks? This is a quiet group today. We're trying to get our heads around
waking up,
being back here at this time of morning. But thank you all for coming. I knew you'd come around.
Yeah.
Representative.
Have we, you know, in this day of age, we have virtual schools. Have we looked into the rural community to even pay for, say, a satellite hookup for someone that's in a remote area so they can attend a school right from their own home instead of doing the traveling and doing the supplemental housing? Is that a possibility? Have we looked into that? Because I would think that in this day of age, that would be something that we could handle.
Chairs Cowan and Schrader, or actually this time Chair Schrader and Cowan,
okay.
Representative Escobar, yes. In fact, that's why Eastern Oregon is the perfect pilot for us. Folks could live on-site or could not live on-site, but if they chose to live on-site for a couple of years and then they moved away, they could continue their education through the proven distance learning programs that Eastern Oregon has really become expert at. While they're deployed overseas, they can take advantage of those education programs. In Eastern Oregon, actually, in our negotiations, gave us an 8-month model, which in education terms is very fast, to be able to put together a program. Let's say that at Grants Pass, for example, there's a need of some of the soldiers or some of the military families to get a particular kind of course. They not only can provide the distance learning in terms of from their own home, but they'll actually help provide a faculty to go to Grants Pass to put the class on if it needs to be in person. So there's some unique flexibility aspects that we think are going on at Eastern to provide for the needs that you emphasize.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I may add, we offer 8 degrees currently online, so without ever setting foot on campus, one could get a bachelor's degree from an accredited mm-hmm. university. And then we have multiple minors also available online, ranging from Spanish for medical providers to Indian American culture. So we offer that currently.
Thank you.
And
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I'm not sure University of Colorado had a model like this, but when I was going to school there, they had all these Quonset huts. And I don't know why, where the Quonset huts came from. Maybe you know, but that was used as housing for students. So there are creative ways of having housing also, because I actually lived in the Quonset hut for a period of 6 months, and it was quite adequate. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, members of the committee, at my school they had a Quonset hut too, and if I remember correctly, they were all Army surplus from World War II.
Oh, is that right?
I'm sorry, I missed the Quonset hut experience, but then I went back as a very adult learner, shall we say. Well, thank you very much for sharing the program. I think that's exciting, and I'm glad to see that it's moving forward. I think, Mr. Willis, in terms of the task forces, my perception is that it's taken a little while to get these up and running, and correct, that to have a progress report by February, when this is very near the 1st of October, is going to be a pretty tight timeline, particularly since some of them aren't filled yet. Can you give us any more about, I mean, really, quite literally, how quickly you anticipate these committees, groups beginning to get together, and how often you would expect people to be part of that process?
Well, Chair Cowan and members of the committees, and Chair Schrader, the good news here on all three of these task forces is that many findings were made in terms of the challenges in all three of these areas, as a result of the written task force report on veteran services. In addition, because there's already a reintegration team, much of that information has already been gathered. So when these folks are brought together next month, they'll be given a lot of information that they don't have to go out and do from zero. So they'll have a sort of a running, at least a trot, they'll start at least a trot, and be able to move along toward the prioritization of the needs that need to be met, and then what are the resources we might have to meet those needs, which of course we'll share with this body.
Okay.
So I think you will see better progress than you might otherwise believe if they were starting at zero.
I understand that.
And we certainly would be happy to work with committee staff to tell them, here's what we have to say, what's the pleasure of the chairs. And it could be that you'll want us to report later. But we don't want to hurry these issues, but at the same time, we realize the need to find a way to take care of some of these needs. As an example, the wheelchair-bound veteran who can't ride in the DAV van. Now, that's just one issue, but that's solvable because our neighbor Idaho figured out a way to do it, and I like what they did. And so just in that one area, we'll try not to reinvent the wheel here.
Okay. Mr. Evans?
Madam Chairs, again, just 2 points. One is, one of the reasons we're where we're at in terms of the task forces is it took a little while for some of the statutory folks to be named. So we actually were ready to go a little earlier than we could. So we will meet the objective by February. The second thing is we've actually gone back and the agency has been focused on trying to get the VSOs on campus fielded because of the beginning of the school year. So that actually took a little bit of time and effort to get that set up. And then the second piece is we have already kind of started a second tour around the state, many fewer communities, by the way, not 24 like last year, but fewer. And as we've been doing that, we've also been specifically focused on these three task forces and gaining information as we go as well. So we really believe that we're not starting too many steps behind, and we should be able to meet the February timeline with good and useful information.
Thank you.
Can I do take a little bit of a different line of questioning here on two of these particular bills, and thank you for the
information that you've given us, particularly with the Task Force on Women Veterans Healthcare. So I am assuming that that committee will also be dealing with and working with the potential for a site at the VA for a women's health clinic specifically for women's veterans. Am I correct with that? Where is that? How does that relate to this bill, and where is that in process? That's my question.
Right.
Yeah. Whoever can bring the information
In March, they're actually going to open a clinic
right.
at the Portland VHA.
Right. Okay.
The Eastern Oregon option that we've been talking about is still an open question.
Okay.
We've been discussing it, ironically, with Walla Walla Portland and other representatives, that they recognize a need. The question is delivery. And the other piece that we think is very helpful on this is that there's actually been a lot of work done on the federal level over the last year, and we're trying to make sure that we have that information compiled in a useful way so the task force has the benefit of that information as well. So it's probably going to be a more impactful task force than we thought it would be. We're just trying to make sure that all the information is ready to go for when it starts.
One other follow-up question, if I may, Madam Chair, regards to outreach HB 3104. How have our other agencies in the state been responding to having those kinds of links on their websites? Has that been something that needs to be nudged a little bit, or is it something that people are willingly moving forward to do?
Well, Senator Schrader and Representative Cowan, members of the committee, the good news is, because of the State Data Center, when you make an agreement with the Department of Administrative Services on what's going to appear on the websites, that's what happens. So, but I want to tell you that I don't know of a single agency that objected to having that link put on their site, and as a result of the referral of well over 600 people since we implemented in July, I think everybody's on board. And just yesterday, I saw a wonderful piece on the Oregon.gov website from Dr. Goldberg at DHS,
good,
where he addressed his 11,000 employees on the importance to assist Oregon veterans and their families, and gave real-world examples of how they were going to do that. And I expressed my appreciation to him yesterday. He did a great job.
Thank you for that. That was my guess, but I wanted to get it on the record that indeed that this is a concerted effort of across the continuum of all our agencies working with you directly.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yes.
The website action has been superb, and some of the agencies like DHS have stepped up and made it a very personal effort. If, however, the chairs wanted to send a letter emphasizing these examples in terms of the outreach effort and the follow-through, it certainly would be appreciated, because the key we know with veterans is that a reactive approach where you simply make things available if they reach and grab them, as opposed to asking would folks like additional information, that there's going to be a very large difference in terms of the outcome. And some agencies have, as Director Willis put forward, already asked for the postcards. Some have been preparing for other activities and very busy, but certainly a letter emphasizing the importance of it would be very helpful.
Okay.
Is there any objection to the chair's putting that sort of a letter of support forward?
Go with it.
If you could work with our committee administrator maybe develop that, if that
that would be wonderful. And I know Mr. Taylor just convened a meeting, which I was able to attend, dealing with veterans in the community corrections systems and how that's moving forward. And I was wondering if you might say a few words about that, because it relates to outreach as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Evans, about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, contacted me in my role of counsel to the Judiciary Committee, because the Federal Veterans Administration contacted him about the issue of veterans before our criminal justice system, both in Washington and Oregon, when they are located in one state and before the courts in another state. approximately 10% of the Department of Corrections population of veterans. The interesting statistic, and Paul was in charge of the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Affairs, and they've done an excellent 270-page report. And one of the numbers in there that impressed me was that we have 13,000 homeless people in Oregon. 7,000 of them are veterans. That's a disproportionate number. But we decided to convene a meeting on this issue because of the numbers of people who are in the criminal justice system, who are veterans. You were talking about people who, when they went in to the Army and the services, the Navy, whatever, they had little or no criminal record. Now they come out and at an age when people don't normally start to get involved in crime. They also have, especially if they've been in combat, a high incidence of mental illness problems, probably caused by stress. So we convened this meeting in up in the Veterans Administration in Portland. We had about 30, 35 people there from all areas of the criminal justice system, from law enforcement, district attorneys, defense bar, DHS, mental health people. One of the big things we came across, and this is where the Internet and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs can be helpful, is letting all those people in the criminal justice system know what programs are available so that the person who is the veteran doesn't get too deeply into the system. With the right amount of care, the right amount of help, and the right amount of consideration through this process, there's a good chance of keeping them out of the mental health system or having them not go too deeply. And the same is true for the criminal justice system also. So that's one area that's been, actually it's now a joint House and Senate Veterans Affairs and Judiciary Committee effort because of the overlap here. And this was the number one issue of all those people that were in probation departments, judges, we had a drug court judge there, was how can I locate the resources and then tie that to the appropriate veteran. In fact, there was a bill filed last session that during our meeting on Doug Hawker Road, former Lane County District Attorney and works now before the legislature, there was a bill filed by Jesse Barton, who's involved in he's head of the bar's veterans outreach program, mm-hmm. and he's also represents one of the veterans organizations. He had a bill last session that, except for murder and rape, would allow the courts and district attorneys more discretion as it relates to sentencing and programs for veterans before the courts. As you know, we have about 700 veterans that are coming back to the state in the next year or so. We had the largest deployment since World War II. Many of them have been on 3 deployments, if not more. Research shows that they've been there that long and that many of the deployments, they usually have marital difficulties. Oftentimes that gets them involved not only with the civil side of the court, but with the criminal side of the court. So these are all issues that we're working on as it relates from a criminal justice perspective. Now, needless to say, most veterans that come home do not have that come involved with the criminal justice system. Why? I guess we're all different. Oftentimes a chemical makeup in the brain and our experiences in combat can be different for everyone. So,
well, I think the key is to try to get people appropriate services in a timely manner to forestall worsening mm-hmm. problems for whatever the reason. So it was one of the things that I alluded to, that I think this is a nice matchup. Frankly, with your work with both of these committees, mm-hmm. we'll be able to connect some of these issues, and we are scheduled at our November meeting to go into more detail right. about the veteran and criminal justice system combined issues. Were there any other questions on any of this multitude of subjects?
One more mm-hmm. follow-up, Madam Chair. I'm very talkative today. I do apologize. I didn't think I was this awake when I arrived this morning. But Paul, could you tell us a little bit about the October 15th meeting? Perhaps some of the folks who are here today, my colleagues, may want to come to that meeting if you gave them the specifics about it.
I will, Madam Chair, okay. Yes, I can do that, and then I will hand it off to Jim, who can talk more about it. One of the many things that the Oregon reintegration team that was started back in 04 with Jim Willis and General Caldwell and a whole host of folks, Scott McCray, Jack Hines, was the recognition that because we're so far away from the flagpole that we're kind of on our own for a lot of things, and we have to make sure that we partner well. And every 6 months, all the folks that want to be there, basically, it's a self-invitation kind of thing, that have some aspect of veterans policy, whether it's education, employment, healthcare, housing, retirement, women's health, transportation, come together in Salem for a summit. And I think it started out, at least the story I'm told is it started out with 15 people trying to figure out how we could do things better for folks. And now I think the last time there were 250, 300 folks there. October 15th, it's going to be at the Anderson Readiness Center. I think the official time to start is at 9, but it's good to be there early because of traffic and parking. This one's going to be exceptionally special for a couple reasons. One is the 41st Brigade Combat Team commanders, actually, we're hoping anyway, going to be on a teleconference so we can kind of root them, wish them well. As you know, they've had kind of a rough go of it, and they've only been there a couple of months. What normally happens is there's two or three main themes in terms of speakers that emphasize specific issues that have been learned or have become more significant over the last 3 months, and then there's a breakout where folks can literally make sure that everybody's on the same page. And I think of all the things that government does, the Reintegration Summit is probably one of the more valuable tools that we have. It, in fact, is the model for some of the things we'd like to try to learn to do with the Reintegration Task Force, we think, is one of the many tools. So October 15th, plan on being there at the Anderson Reagan Center if you can make it. We certainly would appreciate your attendance, and I'm going to hand off the specifics to Jim.
Okay. I appreciate the support from the executive branch of government that I always receive from Paul, but it starts at 8:30, Paul.
Okay.
Just to get there early, just thought I'd tell you. So you do want to be there earlier at 9 o'clock. And this plays very well into the final thing, Madam Chair, that I wanted to express about what this body did. And that's when you passed House Joint Memorial 4, which was the 90-day soft landing for Oregon National Guard and active reserve troops. I want to tell you what's happened to that memorial. I'm very pleased about this. The Oregon Department of the American Legion passed a resolution in direct support of this federal legislation, which is Senate Bill 1426 and House Resolution 3358. They're both currently pending before the United States Congress and Senate. When the American Legion passed that resolution here in Oregon, it was taken to the National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky, where it was passed by the national body, the largest veterans organization in the United States, and specifically passed what they called the Oregon Resolution. That then becomes national policy of the American Legion. Next, it was taken to the National Association of Directors of Veterans Affairs in Asheville, North Carolina. They passed it unanimously because they realized that if this impacts Oregon Guardsmen and Oregon Active Reserve, it certainly would impact them across the nation to allow this 90-day soft landing. Last weekend, it was taken to the Military Officers Association of America at their biennial convention in Medford, where they passed it unanimously. Today, in Reno, Nevada, the World War II Merchant Marine will vote on a resolution to support the 90-day soft landing. And next month, the Vietnam Security Police Association will vote on a resolution in Phoenix, Arizona. My point in telling you this is that veterans of all eras, commissioned officers, non-commissioned and enlisted, are voting in huge numbers to support Oregon's 90-day soft landing plan, which will pay Title 10 dollars at 100% for the first month of their return, 75% for the second, and 50% for the third. During that time, members of those organizations who are identified as having challenges with physical or mental health evaluations, employment counseling and assistance, marriage and family counseling, financial management counseling, educational counseling, and finally counseling and assistance on benefits available to them through either the Department of Defense or the Department of Veterans Affairs will be taken care of. The beauty of this thing, and I've talked to senior guard officers and senior NCOs, is that when you go on to the 90-day soft landing plan on return from the combat zones, the senior officers and senior enlisted or senior non-commissioned staff are aware of those folks who are perhaps having family problems, who are having financial problems, having problems transitioning into higher education, although that is their plan, those that are having trouble finding a job. And this gives them the time to do that transition, and at the same time, these same leaders know those people who are stable, who are ready to go back to their job they left when they were called up. They've got a good solid marriage. They're on solid financial ground. They don't need to stay in that whole 90-day time, and they can be released to go on about their civilian job and their civilian lives. So we are in a situation that I like to call you can pay me now or pay me later. And so when we talk to the Department of Defense, and as a matter of national policy, you're continuing to call these people up, and they're serving 3, 4, and 5 deployments, there's a price to be paid for putting people in harm's way that many times from 2001 through 2009. We don't want to pay that price that we paid for the Vietnam generation for 4 decades. So let's take care of these people now, let's get them on solid ground, and let's move them out. So this memorial that began in this body has resonated across the nation with people who know and understand the issue. I certainly hope that the Congress will take affirmative action on this 90-day soft landing, because it's about saving lives, it's about saving families, and it's about creating jobs and giving educational opportunities to people who deserve it. And I very much appreciate what you've done, and Madam Chair, that concludes what I have for you today. I do have some written testimony there, and also you have these little cards which address the 4 key issues that we also talked about in the best Senate bill that never passed, Senate Bill 606. Which was traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, military sexual trauma, and suicide. The suicide prevention classes that I had mentioned to this body before concluded last Tuesday with veteran leaders who are going to launch our pilot program in Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes counties. I'm very excited about this. This one literally has the ability to save lives in a veteran who is in a suicide crisis. And a trained veteran responds with first responders to talk to that veteran and do their best to talk them out of this action and keep them alive. I believe that program is going to work, and when it does, it's our intention to take the program statewide with specially trained veterans working in concert with our first responders, fire, EMT, 911 dispatch, and police. I'm just convinced it's going to work, and I don't think we need to wait in Oregon for someone else to come along with a program and say, well, why don't you try this? I'd rather them use the Oregon plan, because it's going to work. So, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your focus on HJM-4. If we are successful as this moves through Congress,
yes,
that will be very rewarding for us to step back and say, you know, this really did work when we started by just signing a memorial because it made everybody feel good. But we had a belief going in that there was some energy behind that on the national level. And if we can take that all the way through, that would be very rewarding for for this body's effort. I think I had a question over here, and then I'll come back. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, just one quick question, because you're talking about guys returning and after 3, 4 tours of duty. And I know on the enlisted side, they don't have a lot of support when they come back. And you were talking about if they seem like everything's all together and everything, you know, they might only get 30 days of support. I'm just wondering if we need to do something or what we could do for follow-up, because lots of times, especially as males, we have a lot of pride, and we like to show that we have it all together, and we don't have it all together. And the stuff that these guys are going through, you know, where we just gave a follow-up call to them 90 days out, 120 days out, hey, how are things going? Because some of the stuff may not hit till a year later. So it's real easy to keep it together for a year, but it's after that year, and that's when some of the stuff could happen. And sometimes it just takes a call where you call me and say, hey, Jim, how are things going? You know, and you catch me on that right time, you know, and hey, I had it together for a year, but it's falling apart now. So I'm just wondering if there's something we can do or if there's something we can implement to make sure we make those calls, you know, in three-month intervals to the guys, because they may have it together financially, but everything built up inside comes out a year later down the road that happened to them while they were over there.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Widener, let me just tell you, the short answer to that is you can continue your very strong support of our state reintegration team. That team, along with our Oregon Military Department leadership, is very aware of those exact issues you just raised in terms of beyond the 90 days. This is an issue we're going to have to deal with for a number of years because of individuals being different.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them are not going to come to terms with the challenges that they faced by these multiple deployments for a couple of out years. Now, the good news is I can assure you that the Oregon Military Department leadership is aware of that. The other thing I want to assure you is that the Oregon Reintegration Team, while dealing with the Oregon Guard personnel and their families, also extends its services to the active reserve component and their families, and to the families of active duty personnel who happen to live in Oregon while their loved one is in the combat theater. So we're doing good work, and specifically the Guard's Reintegration Team is doing good work beyond just the Guard and reaching out to others who need their services. So there is a realization we're in it for the long haul here. So we're going to have to look at these young people who say, where am I going to call when I have this crisis? And if you will look at this partnership that we've given you in these cards, we partnered with the Purple Heart, the DAV, the American Legion, and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, so that no one living anywhere should have any problem contacting someone that cares about them and the challenges that they're incurring, even in the out years from their return from combat. We just got to keep the pressure on, we've got to keep the resources available, and we've got to keep it advertised so that they'll understand where we go and where we make the call.
Thank you. Follow up quickly, yes. And then we're going to go back over here.
Just
and then
quick follow up. My point was sometimes as men, we will not make that call.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything we can do to, when we recognize guys that have came out of deployment and we call them? Because then that turns the light on that, hey, I need help, or may not register that day where I follow up and call back. But if it's just a website or something like that, then I'm having to come forward and say I have a problem, where if someone's coming to me and reaching out to me, it's a totally different thing. So, because they need to know there's someone calling that actually cares. Because if you just call a number, it's like, oh, this guy, does he care or not?
No, I understand.
Representative, your point's well taken, and I think that we will be focusing, continuing to focus on the reintegration effort at the November meeting, which this is part of. I think, Mr. Evans, you were trying to get a response in there.
Chair Cowan, Chair Schrader, Representative Widener, the point you raise is not only true, but it's very, very true. folks that are deployed, regardless of Guard, Reserve, active, and sometimes the families of deployed, are reticent to raise their hand and say they need some help. This is one of those moments, one of those rare moments where you are not only doing what you can do, but you're on track to do things that we don't even know we need to do yet. Senate Bill 700, and what we believe will be some of the outcomes of the reintegration bill and that task force, are going to hopefully do for the 36 months after return what the reintegration team has kind of started to do in Oregon. Oregon started it, Congress heard about it, created something called the Yellow Ribbon program, which now replicates what Oregon has been doing for several years. We're hoping to be leading the charge again, recognizing that these wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, potentially other places aren't going away, and that the impact doesn't simply go away even once you get back. So we're hoping that the discussions and the conversation at not only October, but as the Senate Bill 700 group gets together and starts working through these issues, we can go to the heart of that and figure out mechanisms that are not just proactive outreach, but also potentially monitoring, potentially engaging the faith community, engaging other connectors, so that we don't even have to wait to find out the person needs help. We can basically be tracking in a supportive and loving way. And I'm terribly excited about what I think is going to be happening with some of the proposals. And the thing you can do, sir, is, you know, just because the folks that are named on the task force, everybody can be a part of it. We need more ideas. We need support. And I would welcome everybody on this committee, if not being a member in person, if you have ideas, certainly when the ideas come out, supporting them, we can make a tremendous difference. And lest we forget, as Mr. Taylor emphasized, we have close to 3,000 kids overseas right now. We have 700 getting ready to go again. By May of next year, we will have deployed close to 95% of the National Guard within a 24-month period. So it's a huge impact. And the first 36 months are critical. And we need your continued help. You've done great things now. We just need you to keep it up and help pass some of those proposals that we think we're going to come up with.
Senator Schrader? Actually, I just wanted to wrap up a little bit by thanking Mr. Willis, because I want to let you know what a wonderful department you have. Tom Mann's been great to work with, and I know firsthand how dedicated you've been to the cause for our veterans, because I know you're a veteran yourself, if I'm not mistaken. And I also want to thank the governor's office for stepping up to the plate and everyone working together to really deal with the issues of multiple deployments and the support that they need to give the families, because usually it's the spouse that notices something first, and the innovative way you've identified how to approach the families, so the person who is unwilling to step up for the help, actually a family member knows they're going to have to nudge to go there. So, but thank you. I think you're doing a fabulous job in setting national models. So.
Thank you. And just a reminder, Senator Schrader and Representative Barton are members of the Reintegration Task Force, and so they'll be kind of our key contact people, but all of us are welcome to be part of that. Representative Boone, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, thanks for what you're doing, and especially that pilot program with the suicide prevention. And I'm just wondering, I know it's a pilot, and I don't remember what you said, how long it's going to be, but how can we, in the meantime, maybe in our districts locally? I know I'm thinking out loud here. I know that really works. I know you're right. In our small areas, we have identified some people who are combat veterans, and I know some of the firefighters have called them and said, could you come with us on this one? You know, they're not sure. Somebody's triggered with a gunshot, especially hunting season, stuff like that. And I'm just wondering, how can we do that? Do they need special training, or is a veteran better than nothing in the interim while you prove that your program's going to be very successful?
Well, Chair Cowan and Chair Schrader and Representative Boone, I would much prefer that they have training in suicide intervention techniques. But what you just said was a veteran who is committed to helping another veteran is better than nothing. But my concern is, why are they going? There are some people that are combat veterans that are dealing with so many stressors themselves that they really aren't the right choice to deal with a veteran who is in crisis. So our hope is that we train throughout our state a cadre of veterans, primarily those that are combat veterans, who have been vetted to make sure they're the right people. And then here's the beauty of this class on suicide intervention that's put on. The beauty of it is they train side by side with the first responders in the same classroom. Mm-hmm. So they know each other. And the component piece that I really like is the 911 telecommunication managers, our public safety answering points across the state, because without them having the ability to have the call-up lists, we won't be able to get this resource along with the first responder. Now, many of our first responders are themselves veterans, and that's helpful. But we've got to figure out how to stop what is very nearly an epidemic across our nation of these young people taking their lives. It breaks my heart that a young man or woman serves 12, 15 months in a direct combat zone, comes home to the safety of their home and family, and then because of the overriding psychological and spiritual impacts on them, chooses to take their life. We simply can and will do better, at least in our state, and I appreciate your support for that program, and we will get it out statewide as soon as we can, but we got to do it right. So that's why we're piloting it first in what I call a micro metro area, which is what Deschutes County is, and all the way out to our most rural, which is in Crook and Jefferson, and some would even argue parts of Deschutes. So if we can make it work there, we can make it work in the rest of our state, and I'd like to do that within the next year.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of Deschutes County, Representative Stigler.
Yes, thank you, Chair Cowan. And just some follow-up, and I'll follow up with you, Mr. Willis, sure, offline on some of this, but one thing that did catch my eye when I was reading the paragraph in your report on this program was when a veteran is threatening non-criminal suicide, sometimes these situations are such where, I want to say it, where the intent is suicide and the behavior manifests itself in a more criminal way. And so I would hope that maybe it goes beyond just the pure, you know, my husband's got a gun to his head and he's threatening suicide, because oftentimes the cops like to refer to as it, you know, suicide by cop.
Absolutely.
I would like us not to, to make sure that these are not simple situations and that they're not just this narrow category of cases, because usually they're a much more complex situation. So, but I would really like to follow up with you offline on
this. I'm happy to do this. That, Representative. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, I see you. In your report, I would like to just mention that you also spoke to House Bill 2178, the Campus Veteran Service Officer Program, which it appears is moving along well into the beginning of this. It wasn't specifically listed, but I'd encourage everyone to take a look at that piece of your report as well, and certainly we'll welcome any task force updates that you feel are ready and that we should get on our agenda in November, when each of our committees will be meeting separately, but you can make the rounds if there's a report that is needed.
Madam Chair, if you or any member of either of these committees were to get a call on the implementation of the post-9/11 GI Bill, specifically from a veteran complaining to you, which they easily could do, that they are not being paid in a timely way, I want you to be aware of an announcement that Secretary Shinseki made yesterday. The program is 6 to 8 weeks behind in both the payments to the veterans and the payments to the universities and other schools that fall under the program. Yesterday, Secretary Shinseki announced the issue of emergency checks to all people who have registered for the program in the amount of $3,000. The idea being to able to sustain the student immediately while they play catch-up in making these payments, which they're working very hard to do. And I applaud Secretary Shinseki for that decision. I think that's going to take some of the pressure off some of these students and their families, I hope. So I just wanted you to be aware that, yes, the checks are late, but there is an emergency funding mechanism coming out right now.
Thank you for letting us know that.
Sure.
And I see that General Caldwell has joined us. I suspect he has a couple of things he'd like to say as well.
Chair Cowan, Chair Schrader, members of the committee, I just wanted to, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department.
And two questions, one from Representative Widner and Chair Schrader reference. What are we doing with respect to soldiers and families, particularly those that later on become needy of certain resources that may be out there but aren't able to get at them for one reason or another? I just wanted to make you aware that we received a grant through the Walmart Foundation, and we're doing a pilot project down in Lane County, Eugene area. In our parlance, that's the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry's hometown, or their area, and that goes on down to Roseburg, actually. And that pilot is actually designed to inform family members and loved ones of what are the signals, what are the signs, what do you need to be looking for. It's an education process. We just had a meeting on it yesterday. We just got notice of the grant, so we're standing up getting experts in to not only talk to families who will attend, but we're doing an outreach with web broadcast and also the local cable TV access channel to try to get more opportunities for families to look at this. And the idea behind this is rather simple, not unlike what you just mentioned. We know that from experience over the last 7 years that not all these issues manifest themselves in the first 30 days. Mm-hmm. They go months, perhaps even years, before we see something that a family member or something, and usually that's the first notification, that's when you see it first, is things are breaking down in that family unit. And we got to let these people know how to get that resource and where to go seek that type of help. And most generally, the Veterans Administration does a very good job of working with our veterans when they do run into these walls, and there are many of them that do. And the biggest problem we've noticed is that it doesn't get recognized soon enough by the spouse, the children, the mother, father, even coworkers. So without their knowledge of what they're seeing and how to react to it, it lingers for months because, as the good representative indicated, you know, people, they say they're going to man up and push through this, and the result is it just gets worse. So we're doing a real significant outreach. If it works, we're going to seek more grant money to try to do this statewide. We think it will add value. We've got upwards to 400 family units in that one area that we're trying to outreach to. And frankly, I'll be candid with you, we'll have a meeting and maybe 25 or 30 of them will show up. You know, it's a big pie. A lot of people just, one, don't have the time, two, don't have the interest, three, don't see the value in it. So we're going to try these other modes of communication, you know, both internet, printed mailers, and through the cable access TV, to try to get these experts that really know how to teach this to them so they can get it in their hands. So we're doing things that we didn't do 3-4 years ago because we've seen the results and the necessity to try to do it. And we were just fortunate enough to get this grant to do that. So, and if it works, maybe we can find more money or some other means to get it out.
Thank you.
Follow up on that?
Yes. I'm thinking of, and I'm not sure, the programs that you have for families whose loved ones are deployed and they come for an orientation. Is this topic, are these topics, whether it's suicide or sexual trauma, ever brought up then? Because that may be a place also to educate them so that they're educated, you know, beforehand, before they even come home. Does that happen?
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, indeed we do that. Again, our problem has not been that we haven't provided that education and provided those handouts, resources, etc. Problem has been we can't get people to participate.
Okay. Okay,
and one of our keys that we started out with in our first roundtable to discuss doing reintegration is we came up with the magnet that goes on the refrigerator. I think we've shared them with you during the session. I don't know if I should have brought some to demonstrate them. We've actually enlarged them now, so they're a little bigger. And we realize we're not going to be able to satisfy every need that's out there. We didn't have the expertise, we didn't have the trained staff, but we knew who to outreach to go find that. And the objective was get everybody at a base level of understanding that if you think there's a problem or you've got a question, here's an 800 number. It's there 24/7 for you to call, and we will find you that resource, whatever, wherever. We will do that. We'll commit to that. That's probably been our best tool. It's helped us immensely, all kinds of everything, from soup to nuts, that we've had issues with. And that seems to be as good as anything. However, we know as time has gone on, the magnet gets set aside, comes off the refrigerator, it's a year later, and people just aren't thinking on those terms. So that's been our bigger problem, is the reintegration a year out, 18 months out. And that's what we're trying to address with this operation. And again, educating the families before the soldiers arrive and get back on the ground, because that first month is everything's hunky-dory. Our divorce rate is incredibly high. And we mirror the rest of the country and the rest of the military. We're not better, not worse, but we're just about on average. So we're doing, we also have provided through the Yellow Ribbon campaign or through the Yellow Ribbon program, we have, I don't know the exact term, but it's where couples can come on a weekend and we can work through these issues. We just had one last weekend, something on the order of 75 couples showed up, which maxed out. We actually had more people sign up than we had space for, so we're going to do another one. And we've been doing these about every other month, with experts coming in and talking to family members on, you know, what you need to do. Marital enrichment weekend, I guess, is a term that I heard, but I don't know if that's the proper one. But basically, we're trying to deal with this post-deployment. These are soldiers that families that have deployed 2 years ago, and now it's just coming up that things aren't working well. Our biggest issue is those that get out, because we still have access, communication through chains of command, through mailings and everything else, for those folks that are still in the National Guard. Those folks that get out, then they're, if we're lucky, they'll go to Jim's department, and if we're not, they're going to show up at probably the county sheriff's office. And that's the unfortunate aspect and the result.
Well, we'll hope to avoid that as we move through a better process.
Absolutely.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The real problem, I think, General, is that by the time you realize the change, when you come home, you're so different, and your family is different. Mm-hmm. Because they've been by themselves for quite some time. Your spouse is different. And by the time you look back on it, the damage is already done. And the people that are discharged would be the ones that I would think would have the most problems. The other ones we can kind of monitor in some respects. But they don't even know what's happened to them.
Yeah.
And that's the tough part, I think, of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you're right.
I think that's a huge challenge. It's encouraging that the state is trying to bring some expertise together and address it in some way. I don't want to relate it as being anything similar, but even those of us who step away from our homes for a six-month period of time when we're in session or whatever else, you go back and the routines have changed a little somehow. And it's always a challenge when a person is away for a while and then to come back to a new situation. When you throw on top of that the trauma that individual has experienced, I can't even begin to get my brain around how challenging that would be. So anything we can do to help would be most appreciated. I think with that, we've pretty much covered those things that are pending, that we're continuing to work on. I will allow just a few minutes if there's anyone else in the audience who wants to briefly make a comment on any of these specifics that we've been talking about here. If not, since I see that Dr. Cohn's here and we'd like to respect his time, we may go ahead and move into the next presentation. Is there anyone else who wanted to address some of these particular issues? Okay, thank you very much. I haven't forgotten that we will allow a brief break a little bit in a few minutes, but we're going to sort of officially become the emergency services piece of this committee now.
Fascinating.
And talk a little bit about flu season. And first of all, I'm going to take this opportunity in the committees. We've been talking about ways to share with anyone who attends these committees that the hand sanitizers and multiple boxes of Kleenex that are around the room are available to anyone, that you don't have to be testifying and you don't have to be a member of the committee. And I'm sure that the good doctor is about to explain to us the best way to protect ourselves from flu anyway. So I just wanted you to know that all of that is available here to the general public. And I know that you're being asked to do an update on H1N1 in a variety of committees, so I apologize if we're duplicating efforts. This committee is sort of looking at things from the emergency services perspective, so if you could sort of focus what we might or might not need to do from the Oregon Emergency Management and Emergency Response end of things, we would appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Cowan, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Acting Director of Public Health at the Public Health Division and the State Health Officer. Thank you for inviting me to present to you this morning. It is true that I will be speaking with other committees here in the legislature and with the press and so forth. There's an enormous amount of interest in this. And I think I can't say the things I'm going to be telling you this morning enough. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak more generally about the flu and also to speak to the specific issues that this committee is primarily focused on. You all have in front of you a printout of some slides on H1N1. What I'd like to do, if this is will work for you all, is to go through not every one of these, but a couple of the highlights here, and then to speak specifically about the emergency services aspect of this and how we've been working with our colleagues, General Caldwell and others, in preparing for this, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. So that's my plan, if that will work.
Please.
Okay. So first, you know, people use this word, the flu, in a variety of ways. And in the medical world, it has a very specific definition. It speaks to a specific illness that's caused by the influenza virus. And the symptoms of that illness are fever, headache, cough and sore throat, and muscle aches, most prominently. Now, those are pretty nonspecific symptoms, and I think that's one of the reasons why people use this term. They'll say, well, I had the flu, even though they didn't actually have an influenza virus infection, but they had some of these same symptoms. Typically, the flu is quite a severe disease. People are ill for 7 to 10 days, pretty much in bed, and then the cough and fatigue can last for quite some time afterwards. So anybody who's really had an influenza virus infection will tell you this is not something you ever want to get again if you can possibly avoid it. The transmission of this, there's a picture in the handouts of somebody, it's a rather disgusting picture, I apologize for that, particularly so early in the morning, of somebody sneezing and spewing out respiratory droplets. Every time you sneeze or cough, that's effectively what you do. And the incubation period, meaning the time from when you get exposed to the virus until you become ill, is typically 1 to 3 days. That's a relatively short period of time compared to a number of other viruses and bacteria. But this droplet spread issue is very important because microbiologically speaking, these little droplets of liquid that contain the virus are relatively heavy, which means that they don't go very far. They don't hang around in the air for a long period of time. But they do settle on whatever surfaces are there. So, for example, if I were to be coughing or sneezing, this surface here would have those respiratory droplets on it. Fortunately, the influenza virus is a relatively wimpy virus, and with the standard kinds of cleaning that should be going on in most places all the time, that should take care of it. In addition to sunlight and so forth, will inactivate the virus, so it doesn't hang around in the environment for long periods of time. Places where people have deposited their influenza virus on surfaces, they don't need any special closing down and rigorous disinfection. Now, the flu virus changes a little bit every year, and that's why every year you need to get a new flu vaccine. But every once in a while, and the experts say every 30 to 50 years or so, there is a very major change in the virus. And it changes in a way that means that we are all susceptible to it, that none of us have pre-existing immunity to it. When that happens, we get a very widespread epidemic that's also known as a pandemic. And that's the situation that we're in now. I'm not going to dwell a lot on the history of pandemics, except to say that the mother of all pandemics, actually, I suppose I should not say this is the mother of all pandemics. It seems like it's a negative thing to say about mothers, I suppose. I mean, no offense.
Might not be the right chair, co-chairs to be speaking derogatorily.
Not sure about nurturing.
The pandemic that we're all afraid of is a repeat of the 1918 pandemic, which really was a very, very major disaster. It was the catastrophe against which all modern pandemics of any kind really are measured. 20 to 40% of the world's population became ill. There were an estimated 500,000 deaths in the U.S. Of course, our population was quite a bit smaller. That was a very major event. Killed more Americans than all of the wars in the 20th century combined. And the disease was very, very rapid. People became, particularly young, healthy people, became ill in a matter of hours and often were on their deathbed. So it was a very, very concerning event, and that's what we are hoping we are not going to see with this pandemic. And in fact, the pandemics we've seen since 1918, fortunately, have been milder. But the situation now, I think, is a little bit different. For one thing, this virus really has spread in a very dramatic way across the world. I'm sure everybody is aware of how it appeared here last spring. And as of September 25th, so this is last Friday, we did have this H1N1 virus in all 50 states, and over 10,000 hospitalizations due to it recorded here in the United States. So this is just since last April, and almost 1,000 deaths associated with it across the United States. So this is a serious thing.
Dr. Cohn? Just for comparative purposes, how many deaths from the standard influenza do we experience on an annual basis?
Well, flu is, even in a normal year, a serious illness. And it's estimated that there are about 36,000 deaths every year in the United States that can be attributable to flu. Now, I said 1,000 deaths. Of course, that's only since late April. And we had our summer season that was, things were relatively quiet with flu. That's typically what happens. Although the H1N1 virus did not go away over the summer. It did not take a summer vacation. And in fact, what's happened is that the viruses that are circulating in the community now are all essentially this new pandemic H1N1 virus. The other viruses disappeared over the summer. We're expecting they may well reappear at some point later this fall, but at this point we're seeing all of the influenza illness that we're seeing, we believe, is this new, due to this new strain.
Thank you.
Now, there are a couple of things that are different about what's happening with this new strain from the seasonal flu, in addition to the fact that it didn't take a summer vacation. For one thing, the age distribution of people who've been affected is different. For seasonal flu, we're typically very concerned about those above age 65 and young children. What we have seen with H1N1 is that young adults seem to be disproportionately affected. With respect to hospitalizations, children and really up through age 50, we've been seeing substantial numbers of people hospitalized. And the situation with deaths, and I believe it's slide number 16 in your handout, shows these are national figures, not Oregon figures, but what you can see is that far and away the largest number of folks who have died from this are in the 25 to 49 year age group. So that has implications for who we ought to be using our vaccine for, because these are the folks who appear to be primarily at risk for this new strain, and I'll talk more about the vaccine in a second. Okay. So now I want to move into what we're doing to prepare and do what we can to reduce the effects that this is going to have in Oregon. And I guess I should say by way of a status report, we are, I believe, beginning to see an uptick in cases here. We had a school closure that was just announced, I believe, this morning in Jackson County. It's a small district, but nonetheless, the reason the school was closed, this is not really a disease prevention strategy. And the reason I say that is because the virus is everywhere throughout the state, throughout the country, in fact, throughout the world at this point. So closing the school is not going to stop this. On the other hand, if a third of your students and staff are out ill, it's pretty hard to continue to function safely and effectively. So this is a decision that is being made by each school district with input and collaboration from the local health departments. And, of course, we're providing some advice and consultation on that as it's appropriate as well. So I don't want to tell you we're not going to see any school closures, but I think the numbers are probably going to be relatively small and hopefully relatively short-lived. The school district in Southern Oregon that I mentioned, I believe they're going to just be closed this week and expect to reopen on Monday. So the primary ways that we have to combat this, first are the things that Representative Cowan referred to. So covering your cough or sneeze with something other than your hand. We call this using the Dracula maneuver, if you will. And the reason is, again, if you get virus on your hands because you've covered your cough with your hands and then you touch somebody or touch a surface somewhere, that's a perfect way to communicate the virus. So we want to make sure that people are using a tissue or a sleeve or something else. Washing your hands frequently, that's something that we've known for many years prevents all kinds of diseases. And we don't do enough in all kinds of settings, not only medical settings, but also for the general public. So encouraging kids in particular, but all of us, to wash our hands more frequently. And then finally, staying home when you're ill. This is a difficult issue for many areas in the workforce, particularly lower paid workers who don't have sick time. You know, the incentive for them to come in when they're ill is very potent. But we have been trying to get the message out as strongly as we can that encouraging people to stay home when they're sick and putting in place the mechanisms so that they will have incentives to stay home when they're sick, very, very important. It may seem like it's wise to get folks coming in to work because, well, people should come into work when they have a job. On the other hand, if they infect all of your staff and then you have a lot of people out, particularly all at once, that's obviously a very difficult situation to manage. So that's good advice. It's not particularly high tech. And by the way, the hand sanitizer, the alcohol-based hand sanitizers are effective against this virus, so we are encouraging their use as well. After that, the next step up are the influenza antivirals. This is a class of medications that can be used both to treat people who are ill and also for prophylaxis or to prevent people from getting ill if they've been exposed. To be frank, I think the role of these drugs in control of this pandemic has been overplayed a great deal. And the reason, there are a number of reasons why I believe this is so. First, we're beginning to see some resistance to these medications out there, and that typically happens when it's in widespread use. So we want to make sure we have it for the most severely ill people who need every little bit they can to help them. And so that's one major issue is the development of resistance. The second is it's just simply not feasible to put people on these medications for the duration of the flu season. You know, this is something that could go on for a year, perhaps even more, and it just doesn't make sense to do that. Getting people to take medication, if any of you have ever even taken something as simple as antibiotics, just getting people to take a 10 to 14 day course of antibiotics can be a challenge. So to think of another medication like this, it's very, very difficult. However, there are situations where it does make sense, and there are guidelines out there and so forth. We do have a small stockpile here in Oregon that's a little bit that we bought ourselves, but primarily has come from what's called the Strategic National Stockpile. I presume most of you have heard of this at some point around emergency preparedness. This is a federal cache of, it's not only antivirals, there's other medical equipment that's included in that as well that can be deployed to Oregon or in other places around the country as needed. And so that is a resource that's available to us if we get to the place where we need to deploy it. But really, the best defense against this pandemic is going to be vaccine. So the issue with the vaccine is that it takes probably the better part of 6 months to actually produce this vaccine. It's a very complicated process. There are lots of ways it can go wrong. And the federal government, since the appearance of this new strain, has paid for the development and production of this vaccine, and we are on the verge of having it available here in Oregon. We are expecting in the next week or so that we may well have the beginning of some vaccine on the ground here. So given the fact that we're likely to get vaccine, the next question is, well, who should get the vaccine? I already told you that the epidemiology of the way this virus has been playing out around the world is a little bit different from seasonal vaccine. And so the Centers for Disease Control has identified some particularly high-risk folks who they believe ought to be at the center, at the front of the line for getting vaccine. So these include pregnant women, children from 6 months of age up through, I should say children and young adults, excuse me, up through age 24. Children under 6 months of age unfortunately don't respond to the vaccine, so the recommendation there is to vaccinate their providers. Typically, young infants would be mostly with their parents or whoever is looking after them day to day, so those are folks who ought to get vaccinated as well. Those above age 24 up to age 65 who have chronic conditions that would put them at risk, so somebody, for example, who's had cancer chemotherapy or who has asthma or heart disease that would put them at risk for this kind of respiratory virus. And then finally, healthcare workers, because these folks, of course, people who are sick go to see healthcare workers, and they are vulnerable, and so you don't want the healthcare workers to become the vector going from patient to patient spreading this disease. So those are the recommended groups for CDC vaccination, and we're trying very hard to reach out to these folks and ensure that they know when the vaccine is going to be available, that they will know it's here, and that it's very, very important for them that they do get vaccinated. I want to say very clearly to all of you and on the record that we are not mandating that anybody get vaccinated. You know, this is going to be a personal choice that people are going to have to make. And it's really a question of assessing risks and benefits. I've told you some of the risks that, from where I sit anyway, around the flu. And I think there's probably a tendency for many people, because we see the flu every year, and in fact we tolerate quite a large number of deaths from the flu every year, to think that this really isn't a big deal. Well, if you think about how many people are likely to get ill, the estimates we've been using for planning are that it may be as high as 30 to 40% of our population who's going to get this new strain of flu. In a typical year, about 10% of the population gets ill. So if you think about three or four times the number of ill people, three or four times the number of hospitalized people, three or four times the number of deaths from this virus, it becomes an even more serious concern. So I think everybody is going to have to balance the concerns they might have about getting vaccinated with the risks that they will have if they're not vaccinated and they do get infected with the flu. The initial doses of vaccine that are going to arrive here are going to be the nasal vaccine, and by that I mean there is a form of the vaccine that's actually a spray that gets sprayed in the nose rather than an injection. There are some limitations on who can get that vaccine. It's actually people between the ages of 2 and 50. That's the age groups for which this vaccine is licensed. And some other folks, it's actually a live virus vaccine, and so there are some other folks for whom that's not a good idea and the vaccine's contraindicated. But the first doses of the new vaccine we will be getting will be this nasal spray, and then, or the, it's also known as the live attenuated influenza vaccine, and we will be getting, we hope, the injectable form as well.
Question? Yeah. The live vaccine, is that very good for pregnant women? I'm a little concerned that a pregnant woman would get a live vaccine.
Chair Cowan, Sarah Monis Anderson, I believe that vaccine is not indicated for pregnant women, so it would not be given to them.
Follow-up question. My understanding was the injectable form of the vaccine would require two injections. Does the nasal application require two as well?
Chair Cowan, this your question illustrates what's been so incredibly difficult about preparing for this. I mean, the logistics of doing this alone are enormous. If you add up the number of people who fall in those groups that I mentioned to you that CDC has identified as being at particularly high risk, it's almost 2 million people here in Oregon. So it's a huge proportion of our population, and that's way more, that's a larger number of folks than we vaccinate in a typical year by a long shot. So the logistics of that are already complicated enough. The initial reports that we heard about the H1N1 vaccine were that two doses were going to be required. And actually for the seasonal vaccine, for the typical vaccine we give for young children up to age 9, two doses are in fact required. The idea is that young children, their immune system has never seen an influenza virus or not much, not very often, and therefore they need to be exposed and then kind of have a booster in order to develop full immunity. So the thinking was, since this is a new virus, that in fact that would be the case for everybody with the H1N1 vaccine. The initial tests that have come out and that were recently published in the New England Journal suggest that one dose is adequate, and so that's good news, although we still have some unanswered questions about children, for example, and whether they are going to need two doses or not. At this point, I expect that adults above age 9 or 10 will need only one dose of the vaccine in order to develop immunity. So that's good news, I think, for everybody.
Thank you. Representative
Matthews. Thank you, Chair. Dr. Cohen, I had a question about if you could expand on first responders. Are they included in the healthcare worker? Is that the case? And also, was it consideration of military members? And I, with respect to the population and what you're talking about with numbers, just curious what the consideration was there.
Representative Matthews, Chair Cowan. The first responders are included in the definition of healthcare providers, so those folks under the CDC priority groups would be included. The Department of Defense, I believe, is already planning to vaccinate active duty soldiers, and we are going to be as well encouraging folks who are frontline public safety folks to get vaccinated as well. In terms of the National Guard, they would fall into that group also, and we're still waiting for some clarification about whether that vaccine is going to have to come out of our state allotment or whether there's going to be from the Department of Defense a separate allotment that, as they're doing for active duty military personnel. I expect that we are going to have enough vaccine for everybody who wants to get vaccinated to get vaccinated. Not in the first week, but, I hope relatively soon thereafter. And I think that's where that issue stands right now.
Thank you. Follow up? I'm sorry.
Follow up, go ahead.
My question was basically surrounding our healthcare workers have, I guess, the environment that can be maintained somewhat sterile in a hospital or a doctor's office where our first responders are basically, in any environment, whatever it happens to be at the time they respond to the call. So I'm glad to see they're taken care of, and thanks for your answer. Appreciate that.
I have a follow up. As I look through the priority lists of those individuals who should receive the vaccine, and I look across this committee with a couple of exceptions of parents and a couple of first responders, there are those of us who don't fall into any of these categories. So I think the question I have is, in terms of the general public, people who don't hit this priority category, will those individuals be turned away if they seek the vaccine? Will you be holding it for the folks who are most susceptible?
Chair Cowan, you know, I think the best answer to that question is that we are really trying to prioritize getting this into the folks who are in the top priority groups. And I think the decisions about how strict to be about that are going to depend on what we actually see with vaccine arriving here on the ground. I think if the vaccine supply is very limited, we will be encouraging people to try to stick as closely as possible to the priority groups. If the vaccine supply is robust, as we are thinking it's going to be, then I think we're going to be a lot looser about that. Some of that decision making is going to happen at the local clinic level, because again, the top priority here is to get vaccine into people. And, you know, if we've got folks who are there and ready to get vaccinated and we've got plenty of vaccine, by all means, we will want to get it into them. So the best answer I can give you at this point is that we're really encouraging folks in the high-priority groups to be there and be first in line. We're hoping we're not going to have to be turning people away. And that's where things stand, I think, at this point.
Senator, just a follow-up. Thank you. So what are the drivers that determine whether or not the supply is scarce or robust? I guess that, because that was actually maybe one of my questions, is that what is the supply, where is it coming from, and where is it being housed, where is it being refrigerated, I'm assuming, and what are the logistics of keeping it viable, refrigeration, and housed, and so... What's the logistics of some of this?
Representative Cowan, Senator Schrader, the logistics are very complicated. There are a lot of moving parts in the vaccine production chain, if you will. In past years, when we have had shortages of flu vaccine, part of what's made it very difficult is that we have only one or two manufacturers, perhaps, who were engaged, so that if something went wrong in a production facility for one manufacturer, that was a major hit to the supply. This time around, we're fortunate that there are five manufacturers. Actually, I should take that back. The last I checked, four of them had received licensure from FDA, and the fifth, I think we were still waiting to hear, that may have they may have already been approved. But anyway, the point being, more companies are involved. That's good. So that if something goes wrong, let's say some contamination of a lot of vaccine or something like that, then the other lots of vaccine should be unaffected by that vaccine from other companies. In terms of how it's going to be distributed, this is not going to be distributed through the private sector in the same way that the seasonal flu vaccine is. All of this vaccine has been purchased by the federal government. It is being sent, and the state and local health departments are directing where it's going to go in their communities according to their flu vaccination plans. So it's going to be a little different in each community because the setup in each community is a little different. We are hoping to use our existing structure for getting vaccine into people as much as possible. And by that I mean many people will go to their healthcare provider in order to get a vaccination, and we hope that we will be able to do that for many people. On the other hand, some of the groups that we really hope to reach, like young adults, for example, often don't go to see healthcare providers very often. So we have to have some special kinds of clinics and approaches to reach those folks. Again, that's going to differ a little bit community by community. We are in the process of assessing the plans that our county health departments have put together. I believe the last figure that I saw suggested that about 70% of the vaccine was likely to be administered by health department personnel or personnel under contract with the health department, so that a substantial part of this is going to be available in public clinic settings, if you will. One more thing about that, I also want to make sure I point out to you, we're working very hard to make sure that this vaccine should be available to anybody in the high priority groups, regardless of their ability to pay for this. So the fact that somebody is uninsured should not be a barrier. They may not be able to get it at the first place they go, but there will be a place in their community. There should be a place in their community where they will be able to access it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You answered one of the questions on the cost. I'm glad you got to that. And you've been pretty elusive about when it's going to be available. So my understanding, there's currently no vaccine available in Oregon now. And so if you can get closer to when, and then how long after the vaccine is given does it become effective?
Chair Cowan, Representative Freeman, you're correct. I have been elusive, and that's been on purpose. and the reason is I don't want to be told that I'm a liar. I can tell you that the dates have changed at least a half a dozen times since late August, when we were thinking that we might actually have some real dates on the table. The latest information we have is that we're hoping we're going to be able to order some vaccine later this week, and which would mean, if that's the case, 3 to 5 days or so, the vaccine will actually be shipped. And actually, one thing I didn't mention in response to Senator Schrader, the vaccine will be shipped. There's a company that's going to do that to the places that, so it's not actually coming to my garage or to the health department necessarily. It's going to be distributed through this distribution mechanism that's out there. So I think that's the best case scenario. Is it possible that that's going to be delayed? Absolutely. We had originally been thinking that we would have vaccine October 15th, and that had kind of been our planning date. So it's good news that we're getting it a little sooner. On the other hand, I know that we're not going to get all of it all at once. It's going to take some time. But the sooner we have it on the ground, the sooner we'll be able to administer it to people. The question about how long it takes to develop immunity, typically 1 to 2 weeks is what's quoted. And obviously, this is kind of a gradual process, so you're better protected 5 days out than you were at 0 days, and 10 days out better yet. But it does take some time. It's not an immediate kind of response.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Boone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Cohen, I had my flu shot last Friday. And yesterday, when I was driving somewhere in the state, been driving all over the state this week, I heard on the news that Canada has stopped their vaccination program and several other countries in Europe because they're claiming that it's possible that it makes seasonal flu vaccine could make you up to 3 times more susceptible to the H1N1. I wondered if you'd heard that.
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, yes, and at this point I would characterize that concern as unfounded, at least right now. So our first concern with all of this is to make sure that people are as safe as possible and that people have whatever information they need to make an informed choice about whether to get vaccinated. The last I had heard about Canada and other European countries were that they were considering whether to stop their seasonal flu vaccine. And by the way, since there is no H1N1 vaccine yet in the state, what Representative Boone must have received is her seasonal flu shot.
Right.
I do encourage all of you and everybody in the general public to go ahead and get vaccinated, notwithstanding what I'm about to tell you. So there have been a number of...
That makes us all feel really
okay.
Secure.
There have been a number of studies out there looking at this question about whether or not having a seasonal flu shot would put you at increased risk with H1N1. And I believe there have been 4 or 5 studies in other countries. And none of them have shown that there's any increased risk until there is one study. It's a small study. I haven't seen it because it hasn't actually been published. In fact, it was rejected by a medical journal that raised this question. And I think the reason it was rejected was because of concerns about how the study was conducted and whether its results were valid or not. So I think to some extent the jury is still out on that. On the other hand, most of the evidence is in, and it's not looking like that is going to increase anybody's risk. So at this point, the seasonal flu vaccine is still widely available. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has not changed their recommendation about that, and we're following their lead on this. Is it possible that new information is going to come to light that would change that? I suppose it is. I guess the best recommendation I can give you is that I'm going to get my flu shot. My kids have actually already gotten their flu shot, and I don't tend to change those plans for myself and my family right now, my wife as well. So,
I would should have asked you this earlier too. It's just a technical. How long does the virus live if you sneeze and it lands here? How long is it viable?
Chair Cowan, Representative Boone, typically an hour or two. It depends a little bit on the environmental conditions, but it doesn't stick around for a long period of time in the environment.
Thank you. With that, I don't want to cut you off. I think we've covered the basics of the vaccine. Is there anything from the emergency preparedness perspective? I know we've been planning for some time about protection and distribution of the vaccines and that sort of thing, and we've been telling the workforce to anticipate how they can, or the business community, how you can have a business continuation plan with a 30-40% absenteeism rate. Any updates from the emergency preparedness end of things?
Well, first I should say we've been working very closely with our colleagues, some of whom are in the audience here, you know, certainly General Reese, General Caldwell, Ken Murphy at Oregon Emergency Management, Paul Evans in the Governor's Office, Joe O'Leary, Public Safety in the Governor's Office. Fortunately, we're at a place now where we don't need to call in the Guard. Is there a possibility we would get there? I suppose there is. I'm very happy that these folks are there and ready if we need them to be there. But I'm not anticipating that that's going to happen anytime soon. The other thing is that the folks in the preparedness community have been very helpful with us in terms of thinking through some of the logistics around transporting vaccine, securing vaccine, and so forth. Also, possibly in using some of their resources to help administer vaccine if we get into a place where we need some extra hands. So I feel very comfortable that these guys have got my back. I'm very glad they're there. I hope we will not need to call on them in a major way, but if we do, I'm feeling good about how we've been working with them.
Well, the plus is that so far they're smiling. They're not shaking their heads violently. So, I think we'll feel fairly comfortable there. Are there any further questions? Well, thank you for taking your time to come to our committee as well as the many others that I know you're being asked to present to, so we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. With that, I am going to briefly recess this committee until 10 minutes after. We will resume promptly at 10:10.
spot that you were searching for.
You got to take time like
that. Three solid weeks.
All right, that's only 5 minutes beyond my time frame. That's not too bad. That's pretty good. It's difficult to take a break, but thank you all for returning promptly. We'll move now to a discussion of the 911 system and the task force on consolidation efforts and whatever else Mr. Murphy would like to share with us these days. You don't look like you're racing up here excited to share.
I'm just trying to think if I had everything I needed up here to answer any questions.
Or if you have everyone you need here. Okay.
Chair Cowan and Chair Schrader and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. It's a division of the Military Department, and I have got my seasonal flu shot also. So, and just on the lighter side, I heard a news article in European News that one of the highest carrying diseased fabric is a tie that you generally don't wash. So I'm going to start a campaign here.
No ties. The ties are no longer going to be allowed in this building. I see several people cheering back there.
And I think I've
and a couple of folks ahead of the game already, so without ties.
I did not provide any particular handouts. I just wanted to give you a brief update. I'm sure that we will be talking about this as we go on. In fact, there is a budget note to brief the 2010 special legislative session on the relative merits of consolidation of the public safety answer points. So just briefly go into some of the major issues with 911. The current status of the system. Currently, as many of you already know, but just to refresh everybody's memory, we currently have 50 public safety answering points throughout the state of Oregon, and soon to be only 49 with the hard work of those individuals in the two centers in Jackson County, and they're not too many weeks away from consolidating, so we'll be down to 49. And I do have their director here if you have any questions, which I think is very appropriate. She is also head of our consolidation task force. And as I just briefly mentioned,
if you want to bring that individual up with you, if you're welcome to. It's up to you.
Now we'll see if we have any questions.
Okay.
During the last legislative session in the military department's budget, when it was passed, the following budget note was that the military department will conduct a study of relative merits of public safety answering points throughout the state with the intent of reducing redundancy, with the intent of creating more cost-effective delivery system, and the report is due to the 2010 special legislative session. And even prior to that, we had created a consolidation task force to look at those relative merits, which they are currently still doing and have been doing. And this has been part not only of the two professional organizations that represent the 911 community, which is the Association of Public Communications Officials, APCO, you'll hear the acronym, and the National Emergency Number Association, NENA, which is part of their state's strategic plan to look at consolidation also. It isn't, and it is requiring, you know, as you can well imagine, a fair amount of resources. This is, we don't have any full-time people dedicated to this, and it's working with the volunteerism of many different organizations in this process. And just to give you an idea, this consolidation task force has representatives, obviously, from the varying public safety representative of, we have eight Association of Oregon County Regions, the Association of Oregon Counties, Oregon Chiefs of Police, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Oregon Fire Chiefs, Special Districts Association, staff from my office, the president of the Oregon chapter of APCO and NENA, and then the League of Oregon Cities comprise this task force that are working. They've been meeting on the average of two times a month since April of this year, and trying to take a very holistic look at the entire process of the issues related to consolidation, whether that be in construction of buildings, internal and external effects on jobs, money requirements, just every aspect of it, so that when we do go through more consolidations, that we do it effectively and with the right policies in mind to support our communities. And I think with the recent consolidation in Jackson County, we'll have a lot of really good lessons learned on what it really does take to make consolidation work. Part of the other, as we move into the world of 911, there's some other projects on the status that we're working on right now. And we briefly talked about this during the last legislative session, is a terminology called Next Generation 911. And this is really just simplistically all about how our public safety answering points have to deal with all of this new technology that is available to the citizens of our nation. And I think our citizens expect that no matter what device they carry, and most of you I'm sure have seen, there is just a multitude of different types of devices that can be used, whether it's voice or data, that can reach a 911 public safety or answering point. And we truly do not see that changing. I think you'll see more and more different types of devices. Most of you might have seen there's even refrigerators that have computers in them that you could dial 911. So, you know, the prolific world of technology is out there and moving. So,
just to encourage storing your medications, a list of them in your freezer. So I guess
and also things like OnStar and some of the different technologies that are out there that just make it more convenient for citizens of our state and the rest of the nation to be able to reach emergency services. And really the evolution of what we all started out with, the typical landline in our home, calling 911, you know, has truly caused a recognition throughout the public safety answering community that they need to come up with next generation technology solutions to deal with this. And probably the largest part of that is putting together an internet protocol network. This is a collection of network entities that interface, that provide underlying internet protocol transport connectivity between users. And it's complicated. I'll be the first to tell you I don't understand it all, and it's and how it to be implemented, and the new types of equipment that we have to deal with, not only being thoughtful about what we do here in the next few years, but what we do that might last in the next 10 to 20 years as technology continues to evolve into new areas that we probably never even thought of. And a good portion of this, of course, is just looking at the replacements of the type equipment and our overall network that supports this. And we are doing some limited testing with a couple of our counties in Oregon on IP, Internet Protocol type networks, and how to deal with this as more and more calls are coming in, or a 911 center might receive a text message, not a telephone call, but a text message, or some sort of video or photograph of an emergency. I think on this next generation portion of what we're dealing with, some of the challenges are is the standards that will have to be set for call delivery, data delivery, advanced call routing, those type of things that you know, that we don't have in place now. So there's a whole unique set of standards, and of course funding for this. You know, these types of networks, we will literally replace a large amount of our equipment and our network to be able to do this. And transitioning to this internet protocol network is expensive, and making sure that it's sustainable. and that it's secure, redundant, and reliable as we go forward. And we are taking a hard look at that. The 911 community has just made the basic steps now to form a committee. They've written a draft charter to take a look at this, and we're looking at also bringing on a contractor to give us some ideas. We did have a brief here, I think about in the last year, at one of the 911 quarterly meetings about the different types of internet protocol systems that are available. As you can well imagine, in our retail industry of vendors that support this type of thing, there's many different configurations that you can set up. So this is something that we're looking at very carefully, and we obviously want to make the right choices that will support our needs and also make the right choices in dealing with our funding that we have. Those are probably, you know, two of the larger projects that we're working on. We've also taken a look to another thing that has been there for quite a while, but it's a growing segment of our industry, and it's primarily the retail industry, is prepaid wireless cards and telephones that are not taxed. You might commonly see that as a track phone that you can go down to your local store, or you can buy these cards that have a certain amount of minutes in them. And there's been a move across the nation with the national organizations to take a look at this. I think there's about four or five states that has actually passed legislation on this to collect fees from various segments of the retail industry. And I don't have actual numbers, but I believe at last count about 18% of the nation's calling system is being used by these track phones or wireless or the cards that have preloaded minutes. So we're taking a look at that too as another area. Some of the other things that we're working on project-wise is looking at security upgrades to our entire system. When you talk about moving to an internet protocol-based system, I'm sure you've heard this in other committee hearings, anything dealing with technology over the internet is the great world of people that hack into your system. You don't have the appropriate firewalls or security initiatives in place to protect it, and the 911 system is no different. In fact, I would tell you that it's probably equally important, if not more important than most networks, to make sure that somebody can't hack into it, somebody doesn't misuse it, somebody can steal passwords, somebody can cripple a system in great time of need when somebody is calling and truly needs service. Continuing to look to update all of the different types of hardware and software in each one of the 911 systems. As most of you are well aware, with any type of hardware and software in the computer world, you have a shelf life. New products come out and available, and we are now working towards a schedule of replacing a good majority of all of this type of equipment. We're also taking a hard look at the emergency plans and improving redundancy. I know Chair Cowan and I have a long-standing issue with redundancy issues, and I think this is very important as we move forward in this arena. The different issues involved in redundancy to support our public safety answering points. There's the constant challenge of these telephone companies, these wireless companies selling out, moving to other companies. I just got my bill in the mail, Chair Cowan, and Embark is no longer Embark. It's now CenturyLink. So we now have some new challenges, you know, as you look at these, to initiate conversations with all of these to look at the redundancy issues and try and work with them.
Mr.
And then,
if I could interject for just a moment for the committee, as sort of a reminder, we kind of smile when these changes take place, but this dates back to the beginning of last session when we had a hearing about the previous year's storms and some loss of services and a lack of redundancy which caused a large area in Lincoln City, Sheridan, some of that corridor, to lose access to 911 for a period of time because of a power surge. And we have yet to settle that issue. It's particularly important when the geographic layout is such that you don't have a landmass to complete another circle, and that's what we see in the coastal areas. So this is continues to be a very concerning problem as we move into winter, and we've got to do something.
I agree, Chair Cowan, and I think it's something as we look at all of these different things, whether we're looking in the consolidation of public safety answering points, improving this internet over the protocol system, working with all of the carriers, you know, what are things that we may be able to do, you know, that can improve that redundancy in some way, shape, or form. And I think, finally, we have other projects, but I think one that I would mention that has been on our list in my office for quite some time is reverse 911. And we've looked at this as a item that can improve the emergency preparedness of the state of Oregon, and looking at this statewide, which gives the 911 system the ability to reverse those calls and warn people for whatever the case may be, whether it's a tsunami, forest fires, different things like that. So those are some of the really big pieces that we're taking a look at. I think the consolidation task force and the internet over the protocol network system are probably the two biggest things that we're looking at that I think will consume a lot of our time, but will make us better in the way we deal with public safety answering of our 911 system and make it more efficient for the citizens of the state of Oregon. I think as far as anything that may come up for the 2010 session, and I do not have any specific details, but I would recommend the committee take a look at the potential of looking at this prepaid wireless legislation. I have many examples from states of how they legislatively addressed it to capture that portion of the industry. And then also the mention of the potential of looking at any way, shape, or form of increasing the 911 tax to cover some of these costs. But again, I don't have any details on that, and it's something that we can work towards if the committee so chooses. And that's all I have.
Thank you, and I'll get to you. That was going to be my question as to what your agency would hope that we would be looking at in the 2010 session, so we can have some more conversation about that.
Yes.
I'm curious about legislative involvement with the consolidation task force and the next generation 911 discussions that are going on. Do you have any legislative representation on those committees, or sort of a liaison key person that you're
Chair Cowan? No, we don't, but would be more than happy to get their involvement. I know in the consolidation task force, as I had mentioned, I think we have a very good representation across the public safety spectrum for sure. But the legislature would be more than welcome to look at this, because it really does affect every segment of your districts, and how we use our public safety funds, and how we address it with our first responders, and how those 911 centers actually operate, and what are the most efficient ways in consolidating some of these centers.
Well, I'm not seeking to have the conversation right now, but if there are any members that might be interested, I would encourage you to talk to Ken about it, or perhaps you could do some reach out. I'm not trying to commit anybody to twice monthly meetings that I heard you mention.
We do have a call-in feature.
But if there is that that link of communication to the committees that are working on it, it's helpful to have a little background and knowledge base.
It is a good link, Chair Cowan, and I think too.
That.
And I have not attended every one of the consolidation task force meetings, but it's also a very good eye opener because you really have to get into the details, and I truly mean the details of exactly how 911 centers work. You learn that a 911 center, how many other jobs they do other than just taking a 911 call. You learn about the job issues. You learn about the technology issues. You learn about, obviously, what's important to each one of the politics at that local level, of why there's one or two or three or four public safety answering points in a given jurisdiction. And you really get a holistic view of the entire system and what makes sense, you know, across the spectrum.
If anybody wants to jump on that,
I had a question.
I certainly don't need another meeting.
But
okay. You were volunteering. Okay, let's start with Representative Freeman and then move to you.
Well, thank you, Chair Cowan and Mr. Murphy. Earlier, you were talking about the next generation and some of these protocols. Within that discussion, is there any talk about bringing some of the dispatch centers up to the current generation, specifically around the priority-based dispatch protocols that some dispatch centers are yet to implement?
Chair Cowan, Representative Freeman, I'll have to get you an answer. I think the answer is yes, but it's fielding of equipment and money issues, but I technically cannot answer that and would prefer to get offline with you and get you a more detailed answer.
Just a real quick follow-up.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me as if we're going to take this next big leap. Some of the centers are absolutely ready to take that leap. Others really are quite a ways behind. It seems like at some point we need to kind of get everybody on the same page. So
yes, sir.
I'd be very interested in being a part of that. Thank you.
Good. Maybe he's volunteering.
I am.
Senator Schrader.
Well, thank you. As you know, much like Representative Cowan, I came from a local government experience and actually had to do a lot of hands-on groundwork with these systems. Our system was CECOM in Clackamas County, and I was just curious, having sat in on a number of the regional meetings, I think that I have seen you at that table numerous times, there was a federal exercise, I believe, a year and a half to 2 years ago, and I'm curious. Yeah, top off. So I'm curious as to what the feedback was in terms of how our 911 systems reacted in that exercise, and what were the good pieces and what were the pieces that needed to be improved, and has any action been taken on that feedback that you received?
Chair Cowan, Chair Schrader, again, let me check into the after-action reports. I don't know any details right at this moment, and I can get back to you on those.
It looks to me that we will be including a 911 update feature on the November meeting as well.
I think it's important to say, and strictly my opinion, but I think in the case of Topoff, as an example, as you know, Senator Schrader, it was a backpack nuclear device, and just to give you an example why I think something like reverse 911 is important, a 911 center, if they had that capability, could make the call to all their constituents that they serve to give them a warning that something has happened. So I think those are the kind of things I'm sure we could say that, you know, need improvement.
Thank you. Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Murphy, I was first of all involved with the preliminary part of the consolidation of SOURCE and CECOM down south, and I believe we've just gotten a building, isn't that correct? Because SOURCE and CECOM are not going away, but they're going to dispatch out of the same building. Isn't that my understanding? Is that correct?
I think that is, and I would ask that Margie Puckett come up here because she knows better than I do.
Welcome and thank you for coming today.
Just for the record, I'm Margie Puckett, Director of Southern Oregon Regional Communications in Jackson County. To answer your question, SOURCE is actually moving into the building. We start moving some of our equipment in a couple of weeks. Our tentative go-live date is 6 weeks from today. And Medford's RVCCOM is scheduled to move in the end of January or beginning of February. Initially, as we move in, we will be co-located, and we're still working towards true consolidation.
Thank you. Another question.
Hello?
Not necessarily a follow-up, but...
Next question.
We discussed about an... You talked about a 911 tax on your phones, and then you said it may need an increase. But is it not true that the 2003 and 2009 legislature took money out of that fund? And did they ever replace it? And if so, why would we raise the tax if it's going to be a slush fund for this body?
Chair Cowan and Chair Schrader, Representative Escobar, that is, to the best of my knowledge, has never been repaid. That is a possibility, but I still think that if we do pursue this, we need to look at ways and how we can fund these projects, and hopefully economic times will be such that we won't have that happen again.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you. And we will schedule some time for 911 updates as needed at our November meeting as well, and then perhaps you could get back with some of the specifics on the questions that were raised.
You bet, Chair Cowan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure who's going to talk about the Owen project, but was there anyone here that was to give us an update on Owen, the wireless interoperability?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Paul, were you going to talk about Owen?
I had planned on
it. It appears to me that we don't have any updates ready for us on this particular. Okay, fine. That's okay.
Get the garlic out.
Representative Riley, did you have anything you wanted to add on that subject?
Well, I know that the Owen group, I actually did a tour of one of the towers under construction about a week ago, and that was very interesting, and things are moving along quite well. I'm hoping that we are able to continue doing the construction needed and get that up, but that was a very interesting tour. The tour was, and I was just asked by a member where that was, and that was down by Klamath Falls. It was a mountaintop installation in conjunction with one of our partners, actually two of our partners, one of whom was BPE. So.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. This is kind of a general comment around 911 and Owen. Is just, I think it's important that we remember how important the ham operators were during some of the last emergencies, and always make sure that as we strive for new and better technology, we always consider how to connect with the proven technology that's there and those that are willing to help us virtually for free at times. So it's important to remember
that.
That's a good
point. Thank you. Well, we left this item on the agenda in case there was something that we needed to hear. Generally, when there's a problem, that's when it comes before the committee, so we'll assume that things are moving forward with that effort. It's not necessary, but if someone comes that wants to share something with us, that's fine. With that, I think that we're going to hand off the gavel here and turn the rest of the meeting over to Senator Schrader.
Well, thank you. I used to have a gavel as a county commissioner, as I know you did, and it's a pleasure to be here today in this new opportunities. And in any case, I am going to put my dear friend General Caldwell on the spot a little bit at this point. Some of this we've already gone through, I think, with earlier testimony, but General Caldwell, would you be able to come up and very briefly talk a little bit about your Yellow Ribbon reintegration team, who's on it, what their activities have been heretofore, and what the future is going to mean to them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, and probably a little bit of history would be good for everybody here, and I'll try to recall it as best I can. But In 2003, we deployed the 2nd Battalion, or 1st Battalion, or no, 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, primarily out of Eugene, area, Lane County. They went to Baghdad. It was beginning fairly new in the war. Wasn't too long when they were there, and all of a sudden we started getting casualties. We ended up having 9 soldiers that were killed in that operation in the year they were there. We suddenly realized, as people were coming home wounded and recovering, and actually it was one non-commissioned officer, Sergeant Vinnie Jocks, who I ran into more by accident than on purpose down in the Eugene Armory. And Vinnie was back with 4 of his mates that had been wounded, had gone through the hospital rehab, and then been sent home basically to recuperate. In that same incident, there were 3 other soldiers killed, and he cornered me after this meeting that had nothing to do with his particular issues or whatever it may have been while we were down there, and he said, "I need to talk to you," and I knew him, and he pulled me aside, and he said, "You know, my guys and I are having trouble, and we don't know what to do." And I said, "What do you mean you're having trouble? I mean, you're back, you're getting a paycheck, you're working." He said, "No, it's not that. It's just we don't know how to relate. We're not at our full game. We're not hitting on all cylinders, and we've got a problem," and much of what Representative Esquivel indicated earlier in this hearing. And I said, "Well, have you talked to the VA? I mean, thinking the VA, whoever the hell they were, because we really didn't know that much about them. Can't they take care of you?" And he said, "Well, we're not even sure who to call." And it dawned on me at that moment that we had done just a terrible job of reintegration, bringing people back in and talking about how do we get them back in normal life or some normalcy. I said, "I'll get back to you, Vinnie, because I don't have an answer." And I went back to the headquarters and I convened a bunch of people together and I said, "You know, we're getting real good at putting people out the door, sending them off to war. We're really getting real good at that. But has anybody thought about what do we do when they come home?" And it was kind of the blinding flash of the obvious. None of us had. We've been so focused on preparing people, getting them trained up, getting them their shots, making sure all their paperwork was in order, getting them into active duty. We'd never really given a thought to that. We'd had one battalion that had gone early in the war, had come back, and we basically said, "Glad you're home. We'll see you in 120 days. And that was pretty much the reintegration we did. And I went back and looked at the records, and there was something on the order of 40% discharges out of that unit. We had no reenlistments, very few reenlistments. It was basically in shambles. The battalion was in shambles. 600 people had dwindled down to around 320. We couldn't recruit. We couldn't retain. And it all came together at this seminal moment that we've got a problem in the Oregon National Guard. We're not doing this. So we went to the National Guard Bureau. That's our link with the DOD, and said, "What's going on nationwide as a reintegration effort?" And they kind of said, "Hadn't really thought about it. We're too busy putting people off to war." So we started at that point. I went to the governor and I said, "Governor, I need some help. I don't have the money. I need you to help me go to the legislature, do whatever I got to do, or give us authority, because we need to start something. This is just not right. We got to fix this." And he said, "You do whatever you need to do. I'll find the money." And that was the beginning of our reintegration program. And frankly, we didn't know what the hell we were doing initially. We really didn't. We invited the Veterans Administration in. We invited Jim Willis in and said, "What are we going to do, guys? Because we're not covering the bases here." And that was actually the beginning of this summit that we had, that we have every 6 months now. Since then, we've been able to, the federal government has stepped up, as Paul indicated earlier, probably a year later, when DOD and National Guard Bureau said, "We need to get everybody in and talk about reintegration because we think we got a problem out there." And we said, well, we sent a guy back, said, "Take our plan, what we're doing here in Oregon." We were the 4th state to brief, and after our guys got done briefing, the general officer was in charge of that meeting, got up and said, "I'm going to have this copied. Every one of you take it home. That's our plan now. Oregon's doing the right thing." And there still wasn't any money. It took a little while for Congress to catch up, and finally they put some money into it, which has since become the Yellow Ribbon campaign, or the Yellow Ribbon program. We in Oregon still are unique in the sense that the state still funds 2.5 positions and some travel money. Some states do it, not very many. Most of them rely on the federal government. And that money has been adequate, but certainly not robust. So with our added effort from the legislature, who's supported our processes over the last several years, we've been able to expand. We have people, full-time people, either paid for through this Yellow Ribbon program or state-funded people that we can be in every area of the state. We've combined, we made some internal changes where we took our family program at the time, had one person for 8,500 guardsmen. One person, that was our whole family program. It was mainly done by volunteers. And we've been able to add, through this Yellow Ribbon program, we've added about 6 other folks, maybe 8 now, that we've got out in the regions. We've combined them all into one element in our business, what we call one director. So one person is basically in charge of the reintegration, the family programs, the job programs that we have. We put them all under one roof so we could keep more integration, because they weren't established that way out of the National Guard Bureau. They were kind of each little stovepipe. So we slammed them all together so we'd have complete integration. And the guy who runs that actually does our personnel operation as well. So, you know, it makes sense if you're going to have people that are, and he also has the medical command under him, which all of those work together. We moved people in and around physically at the Anderson Readiness Center out here on State Street, so they're all can look at each other. And then we asked TRICARE and TriWest to come in and set up an office, which was the first one that they'd set up in their system, where they actually have an office inside our building to handle medical issues or medical insurance issues right in one stop. And we got a one-stop shopping center, if you will. So we've made a lot of changes since 2004, and Sergeant Jock's cornering me to ask me, what do I do? And I think we've learned, and I like the term that we have built this bicycle while we've been riding it. And we've made some mistakes. We've not done it absolutely 100% every step of the way, but most generally, we've learned from them. We've invited, as was indicated earlier, we didn't put a roster out and say, you can come to our reintegration meeting. We said, anybody that wants to come who's got something to offer to us, we want to hear it. And we learned a great deal. We learned that the VFW and the other service organizations were there to help our people. We'd never informed our guys of this. We learned a lot about veteran service officers that we kind of knew were there but never used them. We just never had done those things. So we have learned a great deal. We've got a very integrated organization now as far as we're concerned. We also, as was indicated earlier, and when you see General Loop and General Hitchcock will be up here in a little bit, we've connected with the other reserve components much better than we did in 2004, because we really didn't. We kind of stayed in our stovepipe. So we've been able to, I think, make great progress and move forward. We're still not perfect, but we still have a good deal of service out there to veterans and soldiers and their families that simply wasn't there just a few years ago. So we've taken it on as a serious issue. We've taken it on as one of the most important things we're doing. And again, it's kind of that slap in the face when all of a sudden you're in an armory up in Woodburn, which I was at one day after we had 4 casualties in one incident. And it's hard to describe to you properly, and I wish I was a better craftsman of the English language, because the emotion, the hurt, the anger, all the emotions that come with this sort of thing, we're in that room with parents, children, wives, and brothers and sisters, simply about how we went about notifying people, which was an abomination. And we had to learn. We never thought about technology it is today. There were young soldiers in Baghdad. They could grab a cell phone, a computer, and they could send home to their wife, you're going to hear about people being killed, it wasn't me. Well, I went through the family program like wildfire, so everybody wanted to know, well, then who was it? And so we had to learn some things about technology in this war versus other things that we were prepared to do or thought we were prepared to do. So we've learned a lot of those hard lessons. But when you see those families there that are staring, and depending on you, the local person, because that's who they know. They don't know Big Army. They don't know that general in Baghdad. They know us, and we're their link. And they had a reason to be angry, because we were not ready. We just simply were not ready. We didn't have our act together. So we had to learn some hard lessons. And we've learned them. I think we're doing better now than we've ever done. And it still doesn't mean we don't need. That's why we continue to have the summits. We continue to offer our services to any service member or their family. Doesn't matter. If they're wearing the uniform and they got a need, or they're a retiree and they got a need, they come to us. We became what we term Fort Oregon. You've heard of Fort Lewis. You've heard of all these other forts where people can go to get services. Well, there is none in Oregon. We're Fort Oregon. And we are in 36 counties right now.
Any questions? I would like to do just a quick follow-up, if no one else. We are going to be having our troops coming home this May. How are you in terms of resources to meet that need at this point in time? Because I suspect it's going to be pretty intense. So have you got any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I think we've been fortunate that we've been able to maintain our reintegration team at its current level of staffing. It's going to be a challenge. We recognize that. This is the largest deployment that we've ever had. Yeah, simultaneous to those 2,700, 2,800 guardsmen coming home, we're in the process of sending out another 600 or 700. So we've got one battalion preparing to go out. We're also deploying two units, one next month, an engineer unit out of Salem will be deploying here next month. They're preparing for their deployment and ultimately deploying around the first of the year. Then we have a helicopter unit deploying in January, February timeframe. So not only, you know, we're pitching and catching simultaneously. So, yes, it's going to be a challenge. I think we've got the resources available to do that at this point. If we see a shortfall, I will guarantee you I will be here very rapidly to request assistance from the legislature. But right now, I think we're in pretty good shape. We're looking at strategies because, again, we usually deal with one battalion. That's around 500-600 people. And we're going to have five of them coming home simultaneously. Are we going to be able to give that level of care that needs to be done? So we are looking at those strategies right now. We think we've got a plan where we can deal with it. But it is going to be a challenge. There's no question about that.
Okay. Well, thank you, General.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While you're on the hot seat, I'd just like to thank you for all you do. You are fabulous. And the work you do, Mike, has just been incredible. General, excuse me.
Well, I appreciate that, but my job's not a hard job because, I'll be honest with you, you know, when you're working with the people that I work with, which is wonderful, but when you're taking care of these young men and women who sacrifice so much, my job is very easy compared to what they have to do. So it's not a hard job.
Well, you do a great job of doing it easy. It's not easy, I know, but you do. You make them feel. I have a few of my constituents who have commented on you before, and I should have told you at the time, but they say that you really care about them.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And I can tell that you do. Thank you.
Only a few?
Hundreds and hundreds.
The few who have contacted me.
Stroke me. Let's get a little more in numbers. Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't heard anything at all.
The others are mad at you.
Yeah, we don't know about those. Yeah.
Well, thank you, General Caldwell.
Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, I see two very special gentlemen have also just entered the room. It's General Loop and General Hitchcock. They are from the United States Army Reserves. They came here to give a brief, succinct presentation about the community covenant. The state has entered into a community covenant. However, there seems to be a movement across the state for communities at the county as well as the municipal level to use this process, this notion of a covenant, to get us psychologically prepared for the folks that are returning. And I was going to respectfully ask these two gentlemen to step forward and talk a little bit to this committee about the community covenant process. And gentlemen, if you would introduce yourself and your address for the record, that would be great.
Should be happy to get those out for you.
I'll be happy to take them.
Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. My name is Kurt Loop. What else did you want to know?
Name, address. Where are you
my
from?
Name, I got that done. Address, I live in Tigard, 13714 Southwest Hillshire, 97223. Send Christmas cards to my address, please. You want to introduce yourself?
Well, you could, but
I could.
I'm Dan Hitchcock. I live in Canby, 1936 19th Avenue. And anything else I should?
No, thank you, fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'm here to talk about the a program that the Army initiated last year, and that's the Army Community Covenant. It's been said that the strength of our nation is the soldiers, and while I agree to that adage, we also realize that the strength within our service members comes from their families, their schools, their employers, and their communities. And the Community Covenant recognizes the service that the service members and their families are sacrificing for our nation, and it lays out specific ways in which the military and a civilian leadership can sustain assistance to those families, identifies gaps and voids that may exist in those services, and it makes gives a greater awareness to the sacrifice that the service members are performing to our nation right now. If you go to the first page, the Community Covenant is an Army program that is designed to foster and sustain effective state and local partnerships with the Army, and it identifies ways to improve the quality of life of our service members. It is a formal commitment from the leaders of the community to the soldiers, regardless of compo. General Caldwell was just up here and talked about the National Guard. There are 1,200 Army reservists in the state of Oregon. A lot of those have families. They live and work in these communities. They deploy as individuals, and they deploy as units as well. So it's regardless of the compo, active, guard, and reserve. The signing ceremonies are scheduled in cities that are clear, close to a military installation. Because Oregon has none, we have many communities signing ceremonies, signing covenants that don't have a large military presence there. It is tailored to the local area. Who you have signed, what is signed, is a commitment from that community to its soldiers, and it's done at the local level. What we have found is these commitments, we've collected them, and they've spawned new initiatives and new programs that the communities can initiate to service the soldiers and their families, especially the families while the soldiers are deployed. We recognize the sacrifice that the soldiers are giving to this nation, and we believe that their quality of life should be commensurate with the quality of the service. The next page shows this program was initiated by the Secretary of the Army in April of 2008, and you can see some of the results there of who has signed it, who are the types of people that have signed it in the eight or nine months of 2008. Last December, Governor Kulongoski joined with other leaders of Oregon and signed the first community covenant in Oregon. Last May, Clackamas signed the was the first to follow on to the governor and signed a community covenant there. In 2009, we expected a little over 200 signings to take place, but if you look at the first bullet underneath the picture on the left, at the League of Oregon, the League of Cities in North Dakota, every city and every town in North Dakota agreed to sign a community covenant there. So we expect a little well over 300. Last Friday, the 19th of September, a signing was took place in Vancouver, Washington, at Fort Vancouver, where Congressman Brian Baird, five mayors, representatives from the House, State House, County Commission, the president of Clark Community College, Fort Vancouver Trust, the Park Service, ESGR, and three general officers signed the covenant at a ceremony that took place there. So you can see we're well on our way in 2009. The next page shows an example of two covenants. It can be anything you want, any size that you want. Generally, they're 16 to 24 poster size. They can be foam board. They can be poster size. They can be signed all at once. You can sign all of them except the ceremonial one beforehand so that everybody gets an original. The logistics are up to the community, however they want to handle it. Then generally, they're reproduced, given out, and people can put them in public places, such as the state capitals, city halls, to show the community's commitment to its service members. The wording, the commitments that you make, the signatories, they're all up to the local level leadership. Who's getting the word out? You can see in the next page, we've cast a wide net to try to gather some people to help us. The Civilian Aides to the Secretary of the Army, the Honorable Larry Diebert in Oregon, has joined with Dan and I, and we've been pushing this for over a year now when we were instrumental in the first one in Oregon. The Army Reserve Ambassadors, the Association of the United States Army, the National Guard, and you can just see the rest of the military associations that are behind this. So the word is getting out. And in the next page, the best practices, this is the thing that I enjoy the most, as people that have identified things they can do for their service members in their community have submitted those online, and we've captured them. And so you can go and see what other communities are doing and see if that is something that you'd like to do. Or you can contact them and say, how did you do this? What resources did you have to put together? How much did it cost you? What are the mistakes, the pitfalls you did? Because of the kinds of things we want to do. But you get a wide range of ideas from the state level down to a small community level as well. These best practices and these ideas are put on the website, which is the next page, www.army.mil/community. That'll list these kinds of things that any planner could use to put together their ceremony. Event calendars tell you who's going to do it, who's going to sign the covenant, where is it located. And under resources, you'll get all the planning details a logistician would need or an administrator might need to put together the covenant. There are sample invitations, sample covenants, sequence of events, a sample script, and a lot more. So it's almost a turnkey operation. You just have to sit down and figure out what is it you want to do to support your soldiers. How do you want to do it? Who do we want to get involved? And we'll help you work with that. If that isn't enough, there are some other individuals who can help you with it. The last page is General Craig Weldon, who I worked with for the last, in fact, we spent our last 2 years in Hawaii at Fort Shafter together before we both retired. He's the national chairman for the Army Community Covenant. His assistant is Laura DeFrancisco. And, of course, I give you the contact information for General Hitchcock and myself. That is as brief as I can possibly make it. What questions can I answer?
Questions?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious, do you ever coordinate with the other armed forces?
Yes, ma'am. Please forgive me if you go back to the pictures of the two covenants, and I've given Senator Schrader, there are samples online, but if you look at the one on the right, it has been expanded, what I call an expanded covenant, to include all the services, all the other services. So, yes, the idea is not to just be Army, it is to be inclusive.
Nothing.
It is all the military, because the Marines are doing almost as good as the Army, but they're doing a very good job over there. That's a little bias plug there. No. Everybody pulls its role. Everybody's carrying its weight in our fight. So, yeah, we'd like to be inclusive.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I might mention in the Clackamas County covenant signing, we had the Marine Corps presented the color guard. The speaker was the Brigadier General with the Air National Guard, and we had other services included. So we've worked hard to try to be sure that no one is left out of this. The whole concept is built around building community awareness of the contribution that not only our military members are making, but also their families.
Just follow up.
Yes.
Yeah. In our community in Gresham, we have a Heroes Memorial, and we have pillars of, it's just a beautiful memorial to all of our servicemen, but we've also included our police and our fire also firefighters who have lost their lives.
Yes.
But I think the community really responds to that inclusiveness, and that's extremely popular, at least in our community.
Yes, ma'am. We've given this briefings to the Canby Chamber of Commerce one day, and then the Canby City Hall the next day. And one president's son is in the 10th Mountain Division. The other president's executive director's son is in the Marines. Mm-hmm. And what they've decided to do is put together a task force to work together and be inclusive to all of the services, which is certainly highly supported.
I was going to ask you to mention, General, one of the comments from the chamber. It seemed to me the president of the chamber, and I'm sure you remember the comment, said that we don't really know what to do or how to do it. We don't even know what PST, what these folks are facing. Could you address that a little bit about the psychological need for communities to step up to the plate and move forward with something of this kind and just be educated?
I think in the case of Canby, you've got some time to do some work. They've agreed to put together two people to work together to do this, and they can identify some of the needs, and we can help them with that. Is what are some of the situations, economic, medical, employment, some of the challenges that the reintegration team is trying to help assist with, but we've voids in that, but we've got resources that we can ask more questions. What are some of the things? What percentage are they going to be facing? They'll know what the community, what resources they have. So between finding out what some of the needs are going to be and some of the resources, you can fill out what can we do and what are voids we have. And they've got time to do that between now and May. Does that address your question?
Yeah, I think it does. How many communities, again, overall? The state has done it. The county has done it.
In this region? Three. Vancouver, Clackamas, and the state.
And the city of Oregon City participated, and the mayor signed the covenant at Clackamas County presentation.
I mean, when I say three, there's a signing event, but like in the one in Vancouver, had five mayors in there. One signing, but very as broad as the net you want to cast.
Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. My comment, I'm from Gresham as well, and along with Senator Monis Anderson, I'm very proud. The city of Gresham has, for its employees, they offer differential pay when they're on deployment, which is really great for the families. So I don't think there'll be a problem with us talking to the mayor and our council and trying to move forward. I think the concern I'll have, and I'll look forward to working with you on this, because I think the good senator and myself, that I'd like to be involved in Gresham, is the language. Some things they want to tie themselves to on a annual basis, like we can do it this year, but we don't know about next year.
Right.
I'd like to talk to you about language there. So I'll look forward to getting on your website and also working with you on this issue. But thank you both, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your service.
Any other questions or comments? I want to thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, I have another program that I'd like to mention, that I passed out a very colorful brochure that I would like to leave with you. In the Army Reserve, in April of 2008, established a new program called the Employer Partnership. The Employer Partnership is a joint public-private venture designed to give business leaders tangible benefits for employing and sharing their soldier employee with the Army Reserve. We recognize that the use of the National Guard in all branches of the Reserve in this past 5 or 6 years has been unprecedented. And a lot of employers that were very supportive in the past are now kind of wondering what do they get back for allowing their soldier employees to go to combat. And this is a program that's been put together by the Army Reserve, and more recently has been signed on to join with the Army Reserve by the National Guard. And in fact,
I talked to some people this morning that said that the National Guard has already moved employees in to help with this. It's the first year we had 100 or so employers that signed up for this program, and it's become so popular. At this point, we have over 600 major employers in the United States that are participating. And basically, the framework of the program is to allow military members to go online in a special website, and they're able to put down the job that they're looking for, what their military job has been, where they would like to locate, and possibly a company they're interested in. And as they go through the website, they're automatically put into a company or that company's website for filling out an application for employment. And what we've tried to do in return is to say that you will get an employee that is well-trained, has been licensed, has been certified for the types of work that you have. We started this with the National Trucking Association because there's a shortage nationwide for truck drivers, and also in the military there's a shortage for truck drivers. And so, and then the next was a medical and nursing association on the East Coast that has problems recruiting medical technicians. And so that's another piece that we're saying we'll provide these people that are already trained, we'll save you thousands of dollars in training costs. We'll provide you somebody that's physically fit, somebody that gets a physical on a regular basis, and somebody that is drug-free and also has the type of leadership training that you can't buy. And so we've been working this program now for 2 years. We're happy to have the National Guard on board with us as we continue to move forward. The brochure there, I think, will answer most of your questions. If you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer that. But just another piece, Madam Chair, if I might just mention it. I think the VA and a number of other organizations and the Oregon National Guard and their Yellow Ribbon team are doing an exceptionally fine job. We've got a lot of resources available to our veterans. What we miss really is trying to have somebody that can help military members find where these resources are and get them into the channel. And that's one of the types of things that General Loop and I were kind of a resource out there that then try to steer military members in the right direction and get them in touch with people, at least that we've become acquainted with in organizations. But we really feel very fortunate to have the amount of people involved and interested in taking care of veterans. So the state of Oregon can be very proud.
Scanning any questions? I do have one question. Do you know offhand, General, how many Oregon companies are directly involved with this yet?
I do not. In fact, I tried to find that out this morning, and they have it. But I, okay. In looking at the list, there are companies that from Dell to Walmart across the nation, companies like Lowe's and Home Depot are involved. I know that a representative was working with the state police here and also with the City of Portland Police Department, because law enforcement is another area of expertise that both the military and the civilian community needs, and there's a shortage in both sides of that. But I will get you a list of, and I know that we have there are 20 full-time people that were recruited about a year ago, and the person that works with Oregon lives in the Tacoma area but has Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and he has been spending a lot of time in Oregon, and I believe Evergreen Airlines is another that I know that he's been working with. And it sounds to me in talking with him that any time he sits down and meets with an organization and talks about the benefits of this program to both the military and to the employer, that they're very quick to sign on the line. And then their part of the agreement is they want a reservist in their organization, and they're willing to give that reservist up on occasion when needed. And that's kind of the two sides of that. For example, I mentioned the number of times that reservists have been called up. There's a unit in Portland that's 364th Civil Affairs Brigade. I met with the brigade commander, who is a colonel, and the brigade executive officer, who is also a colonel. This will be their fifth tour. They left last January, February. They're in Iraq right now. And this will be the fifth time now they've been called up from their civilian jobs. They're not full-time soldiers. They're reservists. One works for the Forest Service. The other works for the California Highway Patrol. But that's pretty much across the board of what's happening in the reserve ranks and in the Guard to a great extent. We sure appreciate our working relationship with the Oregon Guard and with the state of Oregon.
Any other additional questions? Yes, Representative.
With the Community Covenant and this program here, have you ever thought of linking them together and bringing businesses in on these signing where they're part of the Community Covenant and they're taking on the role of hiring first and putting together your partnership here to where it's all rolled into one when you're doing the signings and reaching out mm-hmm. to people to be involved?
Yes, they have. I think the Oregon one, the Chamber of Commerce signed, and we, it's just a matter of how inclusive do you want it to be. It's up to them. I'm going to give the two Gresham people. I've got samples of other covenants there. There's one covenant here. It's got 64 signatories on it. So yeah, now that becomes a nightmare for somebody who's got to get them all. But no, it's as inclusive as you want, and it. That's a great idea to highlight them.
In Vancouver, we did a dual ceremony. We had a covenant signing where we had Congressman Baird and the mayors and the other people yes. In leadership roles. But we also had approximately 100 business leaders in the room. And they came forward and signed a statement of support for the employer support of the Guard and Reserve to let people know that they're willing to support having Guard and Reserve employees in their organization and will abide by the laws that support that. So
yeah,
the employers are a key piece, and wherever we can get an employer engaged and also recognize and reward them for what they do for us.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming today. Specifically, colleagues, I did want to get this on public record to give all of you an opportunity to go back to your communities and possibly move forward with something like this. I will let my two friends know that I did get you more work when I did this presentation to our municipalities in Clackamas County. A number of them are jumping on board and doing their own community covenants. The importance of this, so you'll be hearing from us, I promise. The importance of these, I think, is a symbolic piece, in particular to get folks into the mindset to get them ready to be educated about what they're going to be facing when our troops return home and how we're going to be dealing with jobs, homes, all the kinds of things that our servicemen and women are going to need. So thank you for coming today. We do have to move on, evidently. I have a note here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and recognize Mr. McGinnis. He's
yes, I know Mr. McGinnis has been here. Can we have you come up pretty quickly?
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Senator Schrader, Representative Cowan, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Wagner. I'm the Pain Management Coordinator for the Department of Human Services, and I'm excited to be here to share some a really wonderful project with you that we're embarking on in the state of Oregon. As you may know, September is Pain Awareness Month, and we have a series of events that we're doing. If you haven't had an opportunity already to visit the artwork that's on display in the gallery right outside the doors, I hope you'll take a few moments to do that. That is all artwork that have been done by pain patients from throughout the state of Oregon from a project that we did in 2006. It's really quite powerful and remarkable. Secondly, you know, the issues of pain management, chronic pain management in particular in our veterans has come to our attention really over the last 15 months specifically. And for September's Pain Awareness Month, we really wanted to look at this issue and see if we couldn't do something special in the state of Oregon around these issues. So I want to start by thanking the Department of Veteran Affairs, Paul Evans from the Governor's Office, and really the staff internally at DHS. It has been an exciting collaborative project, and with that, I'll introduce you to Derek McGinnis. Derek is a soldier who was sustained life-threatening injuries in Fallujah, Iraq in 2004 as a Navy Corpsman. And upon returning to the United States, he was obviously shipped to Walter Reed for treatment of those injuries, but came out of them and wrote a book called Exit Wounds. In this book, we have them here for you if you'd like them. We've brought copies for all of you. Derek's book is a wonderful resource for veterans and for their families suffering from chronic pain. And we really wanted to see if we could get this resource out to veterans in Oregon. So together, we came, ODVA and DHS, and tomorrow we'll be announcing at a ceremony at the Iraqi-Afghanistan War Memorial at 11:30 that any veteran in Oregon that would like to receive a copy of this book may receive it for free. Yeah, so I've asked Derek. Derek flew in this morning from Palo Alto, California, to share his story with you and just a few comments. So, Derek.
Thank you. Senator Schrader, Representative Cowan, and the committee, I appreciate being on the agenda and be able to address you today. I've been privileged to hear the dialogue that's going on here at the state of Oregon and your support for veterans, and I'm just really grateful, especially to the generals as well, on the work here that you're all doing for veterans and their service members. So first of all, I'd like to say thank you for the duty you're doing. What I'm going to talk about is my journey of being hit and the not just the physical pain, but also the mental pain that all came with that journey and returning home, and also to tie into things that with the relief of comprehensive pain management as well as mental health, I was able to carry on and be a productive member in society, and that's what I'd like to dialogue with you today. So going back, like I said, I did have the honor of wearing my country's uniform as a hospital corpsman for 11 years. In November 2004 in Fallujah, Iraq, I was hit by a vehicle-borne IED, which is a suicide driver, as it exploded into my ambulance. My duties were to provide health care to our Marine Corps and soldiers on the ground and get them medevac and taken care of. That was what my duties were. When I was hit, I sustained a traumatic brain injury, a left parietal bleed, shrapnel in my eye, a left above knee amputation, multiple orthopedic as well as shrapnel injuries throughout my body. The timelines in here in depicting these struggles, obviously we heard earlier from the general about sometimes things weren't prepared back in 2004, so you got to keep that in reference. Today there's been a lot of improvement and I'm very grateful for the healthcare. I wouldn't be here today without the outstanding health care I received, as well as the quality of care I did receive from the Marine Corps.
Representative, do you have a question? Could we? I apologize for interrupting you, but for the record, could you, while you're saying I, insert your name?
Oh, please forgive
Thank
me, ma'am.
Thank you so much.
They just want you to say your name.
Just your name is all we need.
Oh, pardon me about the record. I'm Derek McGinnis, and I'm from Northern. Mm-hmm. I live in California
right.
at this point.
Thanks so much. All right.
Pardon me, ma'am. Please forgive me about
it's okay.
that.
Okay, I should have caught it. Not your fault. Okay.
So that journey obviously brought me back through Germany, Bethesda, Palo Alto VA Hospital, back to Walter Reed. In that journey, there was a lot of casualties, there was a lot of injuries, there was a lot of people coping with a lot of injuries and traumatic injuries. My journey required me to respectfully advocate to get proper care in healthcare management, in which I was able to move to Texas, which is another rehab facility where I was able to carry on. I met a provider there that was able to listen, to meet me where I was at with my comprehensive pain management, which allowed me to carry on with further progress, as well as mental health counseling, outpatient brain injury rehab program, further surgeries, EI, as well as being able to ambulate today. So what my journey is, what I'm trying to depict to you is, there's so much involved in it. For me, as you heard, my injuries were so traumatic, but there are so many others that are also coping with pain that haven't had these traumatic injuries. And what I'm trying to allude to you is that the military service in general and some of the things they're exposed to, pain management. If I didn't have my pain management and I wasn't managed, I wouldn't be here a productive member. And today, I'm blessed to be a father. Of two wonderful boys. I'm blessed to be married. I'm blessed to call myself a veteran. I'm blessed to be a member of Team Semper Fi, giving back, running triathlons, giving back to my own, working on my master's degree in social work, carrying on further education so I can get in clinical counseling with veterans coming behind me. So what I'm trying to allude to, if I didn't have that comprehensive pain management, I believe I would not be able to carry on to this day to be here in front of you. It wraps it all in together. And so now with this mission here and being able to give out my journey and my story for free, obviously a lot, we don't like to discuss and tell our journey and express it. It's a culture and a character that we choose not to do, I have found in my journey. But I found that it's very important to discuss it and to give it out. And I'm so grateful to the state of Oregon with their leadership as well as the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs for helping me with this mission of being able to distribute this book for free to our veterans. You have to understand, as you were alluding earlier, Senator Schrader, that it's a culture and your understanding about certain things. It's our duty to give back to our own, and with the support of you as well as the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and Declaration for September Pain Awareness. I just really wanted to tell you thank you, and that I believe this mission is will be moved forward with. And also, I definitely want to welcome you and pleased to review a copy of the book and your travels after the agenda is adjourned. And I'd love to open it up for any questions or any further dialogue if you wish. But again, of course, I appreciate your time today.
Sure. Any questions? Yes, Representative Winder.
Corman, I just want to thank you for your service and the sacrifice that you've made for this country and for all of us sitting here. Right. To have the ability to discuss these issues and debate them and make a difference. I mean, what you've done for us is more than we could ever do or give back to you guys that are out in the field. I actually have a son who's in the service as well who was actually just getting ready to go back to Iraq. He's overseas right now. He comes back for a month and then he's gone again, so for another 8 months over to Iraq. So, and what you guys have to go through and stuff, the mental part's almost even the worst that you're alluding to, some of the mental pain and trauma that you deal with when you're dealing with bad actors day in and day out. And I want to thank you for everything you've done for us sitting right here.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Thank you to your family as well, sir.
Yes. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd also like to thank you for your service. It sounds like you've had quite the trip. Congratulations on your family and what you're doing here, too. I'm a writer wannabe myself, but you got it. Yours published. That's good.
I'm very blessed.
That's good. But thank you for doing that. I think that's really helpful. And hearing, you know, other people who are in a similar situation, hearing from you who've actually gone through it, and you have, I think, their attention in that you know what they're going through.
Yes, ma'am, that's why I hope that a mission accomplishment. And I just want to make sure it was clear. I believe I was part of something great, and it was an honor to be a part of it. So I just want to make sure I stated that, too, as wearing that uniform made it really clear as well. But
forward to reading your book.
Thank you, ma'am, for doing so. I appreciate you. And I would appreciate your feedback as well for this mission, if I should adjust some things in your travels and what you've seen. It's a flow mission just to start a dialogue.
Can I have a follow-up, too, ma'am? Chair?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I have a constituent who's has traumatic brain injury, and he's been kind of a pioneer in our community, but I know that I'll encourage him to get this book, too.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Be free.
Well, follow-up. Yes, ma'am. How would, I have a couple of veterans, I think, that would really benefit from reading your book. How would I be able to email to them where they could maybe get a copy?
Senator Moniz Anderson, you can refer them to any Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs office. The books will be distributed throughout the state of Oregon for veterans that would like them.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for that. Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I've been asked on behalf of our committee to express our appreciation to you and our thanks for being here and certainly our thanks for your service as well. I too look forward to reading the book. I just recently finished a book called Stroke of Insight from the perspective of an individual who had suffered a left brain stroke, and it's very helpful for many of us who may well have family members involved in the service or other things, but to be able to understand from a first person perspective a little better about some of the things that folks are going through. So I appreciate your effort in putting it together. I know it's not an easy undertaking to write anything either. What I would like to sort of follow up with is, could you perhaps review for the committee and those in the audience or people who might be listening the other places that you'll be speaking that people have an opportunity to hear from you in the couple days that you're here visiting with us?
Sure, Representative Cowan. This committee has all been invited to have lunch with Derek this afternoon at 12:30. I hope you'll all be able to join us. After that, Derek will be going over to the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs, in which Jim Willis will give him a tour of our VA office and meet with him one-on-one, which is a wonderful opportunity. Tomorrow at 11:30, again, the address is 700 Summer Street. It's on the grounds of the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs, the Afghan-Iraqi War Memorial. The director of DHS, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and the director of ODVA will make the announcement that the books will be available free of charge for Oregon veterans. And so that ceremony happens at 11:30. And then pretty quickly after that, I need to get Derek back on the plane so he can get home to his family. And he's been, we're so fortunate. Derek was just in Las Vegas for a national VA conference. It looks like nationally the book is going to be distributed starting in October. So that's exciting news. He's been on the road a lot, and we twisted his arm to come up north here for a few days and spend time with us. So.
Well, we thank you for doing that. Appreciate it.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I just want to let you know, I briefly had a conversation with Legislative Counsel's office. I didn't ask him for an official opinion. And Patty O'Sullivan also had a conversation with the Department of Justice. This book is worth under $50. It's also connected to the work of the committee, too.
Yeah, there you go.
Those things that we have, hoops we need to jump through. But we do appreciate your generosity.
And lunch with Derek. Yeah.
That's the work of the committee, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to just thank you as well. Regrettably, I am not going to be able to stay for lunch today because I will be heading out east, where I will make sure that this book also gets into the hands of a certain congressman, who we hope, Congressman Schrader, who we hope will be continuing to work on veterans issues. So you kind of got a twofer today. You got the state level. We'll make sure we get it to the federal level, too.
So, Senator Schrader, just quickly so you all know, the books will be distributed really through the tremendous support of the ODVA.
Right.
To every VA hospital and clinic in the state of Oregon, it'll be available for the Guard and the Reserves. We're getting it out to as many veterans in Oregon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for
your
time.
Thank you. Well, Representative Cowan, I do have a note here, as we hope move towards wrapping up here by noon, if not before, that Lindsey Ball has come for an Owen update. And
with our apologies, we apparently put Mr. Ball on the agenda without mentioning to him that we
thought he was going to be here.
We're interested, so we apologize for that. But maybe if there's anything the committee needs to hear about what's going on with Owen.
Okay. Chair Cowan, Chair Schrader, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Owen Project. I work under Governor Kulongoski. Just to give you a real brief overview, in 2005, the legislature passed a bill, House Bill 2101, that required the four state agencies to consolidate their radio communications into one, and the legislature directed there to be interoperability throughout the state of Oregon with public safety users. Since that time, there was an initial study that was done for the radio system, conceptual design. I think everyone can remember the $665 million price tag that was attached to that. We've since worked at reducing that cost through creating partnerships throughout the state, of which we have 41 signed partnership agreements today. I think that's extremely important to note. I still say partnerships are a cornerstone of this project. In addition to that, we are also functioning as the engineering and integrating portion of the project. We are not contracting that out. That saved us about $120 million. So that gives you a rough idea as to how we've reduced some of the costs associated with the project. Since the close of the legislature, we now have architect and engineering firm under contract with the Owen project. We are going through RFP processes for construction management general contracting. We have an RFP out, and we are in negotiations with the professional services team to bolster our project management office, which is the office that actually oversees the specifics of the project. We also are in negotiations as I said, the construction management general contracting, and also we're working up an RFP for quality assurance that would cover the project management office to provide oversight there. We have an RFP scheduled for release in December for the radio portion, which is actually the most expensive part of the project. It will be slightly over $100 million by our estimates to purchase the radio equipment throughout for the state. To kind of give you an idea, we've just now, with the contractor Black & Veatch on hand, one of the things that I'm always very cautious about and leery of is the budget. I'm watching the budget constantly. Up until recently, we didn't have hard numbers to understand exactly where we were with expenditures. We didn't have anyone under contract. We were just working with projections. I have some real numbers today since we have Black & Veatch under the architect and engineering contract. And to give you an idea, we have 30% of the sites that have been assigned out to Black & Veatch throughout the state. That's 81 sites, and we've only expended 11.9% of the budget. So 30% of the work for 11.9% of the budget kind of gives you an idea. We're under budget by quite a little bit. I feel comfortable about that. First time that I breathed a sigh of relief in this whole project, because we've been working with all the estimates associated with costs, that's something I can really get my hands on and feel. I feel pretty good about that.
Okay.
We also, I didn't bring it as a handout, I didn't have time to bring it, but I do want to show you that we keep track of all personnel associated with the project. At any time, if you'd like, we can provide this to you. It shows the staff of Owen, the staff of other agencies that are working on the project, as well as our partners throughout the state, and the people that are under contract by person's name. We also have a report that's due to us on a monthly basis with the number of people that the project has put to work who are from Oregon. Today, we have put 73 Oregonians to work in Oregon under the Owen project, and we're just now starting to ramp that up. That kind of gives you the latest brief of Owen that I can think of. Are there any questions I may answer?
Are there any specific questions? I appreciate the spur of the moment testimony, and I think it tells us that there's a great deal of accountability with this project, and all we need to do is ask for more information, and it's available to us.
And I'm available. The one thing that I'm not trying to say poor me, but the one thing I really do need, and I think we're getting that resolved, is I've worked with a legislative work group. We do have our first meeting tomorrow, but that is something that I just want to emphasize is extremely important to me, is to have a legislative work group that I can sit down with and advise them where we are with the project, get feedback from them, because I've always been able to visit with legislators about issues. They hear things in their communities that I need to hear about as well, and that legislative work group is extremely important to me. Any big project I've ever taken on in the state, I found that legislative work group, committee, whatever you want to call it, is vital to the success of the project.
And did I understand you correctly that you do have one you're planning to meet with?
Right. Senator Johnson and Representative Nathanson scheduled a meeting for tomorrow at from 11 to 12 for us to try to get back together again. I've not had that since the legislature adjourned. And that's like a big hole. It's important to me.
There's opportunity available. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm Representative Nathanson, and I are the on the House side on that committee. And anything that any of the House members or the senators want to pass along to the Owen Project, I'd be happy to be that conduit.
There you go. Thank you very much for coming on the spur of the moment. I apologize for the miscommunication. I can't even say it. I'll accomplish it.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Representative Kellen. We're now at the point of the agenda. Actually, we're only 5 minutes behind.
Not bad.
That's pretty darn good, considering where, at least on the agenda, it talks about potential 2010 session possible committee concepts. I feel as if we've really gotten a plethora of information here this morning, and do we need to digest a lot of what we've heard today before we move on to a really robust discussion on committee concepts? What's your wish, Madam Chair?
Well, let's just touch base with a good administrator. What is our deadline for submitting committee bills?
Madam Chairman of the committee, we have two deadlines, one for the Senate, one for the House. For the House, it's October 5th, deadline to get committee measure concepts to Speaker for permission to draft.
October 5th?
The committee gets
next
one
week.
Bill.
Okay.
But that's October 5th. For the Senate, it's November 13th, and the Senate gets two concepts. The deadlines for members to request drafts on the House side are December 2nd, December 15th on the Senate side. Deadline for LC drafts to be dropped at the desk, January 8th. And at the Senate side, January 15th.
Right.
And I might have some comments about that. But.
Well, that's the reason this is on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Because between now and October 5th, we don't have another meeting. And if so, I'm kind of looking this direction at this particular point.
Yes. What's October 5th?
The October 5th is the deadline by which the House committee has to submit any concept to the Speaker for approval. And we will only have one House-generated committee bill.
We only have one?
Huh?
Per committee? One per committee?
One? Yes. Count them. One.
I thought it was... That's they had to go before
one
the
per member. Yeah, the individual members have
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
But the committee
just gets
committee. So the reason I put this as an agenda item and basically laid it out as we began the meeting with the various agency folks was the only way the agencies can submit a bill in the short February session is via committee.
Right. Okay.
And it was my desire if any of the agencies had a concept for a bill that they wanted to come through this committee that they needed to say it today. Now, I heard two concepts mentioned from Oregon Emergency Management around ways to deal with prepaid wireless and the discussion of an increase in the 911 tax. I'm not confident that would move, so but maybe some conversation around prepaid wireless. I didn't hear anything from veterans in general, but I think that's basically because the task forces have yet to meet and to move forward. Representative Freeman and then Representative Widener.
I was just going to suggest, and I don't know, he says concept, so I don't know how, how precise we have to be, but maybe something along the lines of something on the reintegration since that task force is going to meet,
right.
So that we do have, you know, for lack of a better word, a placeholder if they do come up with something they need to have done right away.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
And Representative Widener?
Actually, one of the bills I was going to bring forward, and I don't know if the committee would want to do it or not, but with our campgrounds right now, we kind of limit what where veterans can stay. We exclude yurts and the horse campgrounds, and I was wanting to open it up to where the veterans would be able to stay in the yurts and or have the benefit for the yurts and the campsites. That way, right now they're in the ground, in the campground in a tent or something like that, and bangs go off or noise like that can be traumatic, where if they can stay in a yurt, it's a little more quiet, and it's something for us to give back to the veterans. So, and I know the Senate has too, but I will be running the bill if the committee doesn't want to.
Personal bill.
Okay.
You could do a personal bill too.
I have a meeting scheduled, all of the chairs do, with the speaker, so I can explore a little further with him exactly what the detail he's looking for in terms of concepts. So I've heard four ideas mentioned, I guess, at this point. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's my understanding that we need to actually approve a concept as a committee before we
right.
before this deadline, and
okay.
the only time we can do that is right now. And if we don't approve a concept by vote, we don't get one.
And at this point in time, only the House committee is actually functioning.
So
no,
we're,
you don't have any rules.
We're eagerly listening to your concepts.
Okay. So as chair, Representative Matthews?
I had a comment to make, but if you were going to...
No, I was only going to summarize. So if you have a comment, please...
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment would be that, as we heard today, I believe we had a successful session for our veterans. We had 39 bills, memorials, resolutions that were passed. I believe Representative Freeman has a great idea about a placeholder concept, in that the reintegration is going to be the one area where we might have to make a tweak or something. We won't know that now. Obviously, we can't, but we may know that in the next month or two. Following the summit, so I would support the concept of reintegration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. To summarize what I heard today from agency presentations and what I've just heard from you folks is that there are basically four potential
right.
concepts out there, and I will lay on the line up front that my concern is that in a one-month session. Mm-hmm. Any item that's fairly complex and / controversial simply doesn't have the time to be worked, because if you'll recall, in the last one-month session, we had basically one or two meetings on the House side to finalize a bill, get it to the floor, get it passed, then move it to the Senate side for the same kind of a mm-hmm. timeline, with no possibility of bringing things back for amendments and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm sort of looking for, is a concept that can move. And I've heard four presented, potentially around something around prepaid wireless, using examples from other states, but that there's sort of a lot of discussion about that yet. The potential need to increase the 911 tax, to have some sort of a concept that is basically a placeholder around reintegration issues, from which we could bring anything that the task force
right.
might see as a need, or fourth, an expansion of veterans' opportunities in our public campgrounds. Have I missed any?
I did hear something. I think it was Representative Stigler about the issue of law enforcement and suicide, and I don't know if that's, in other words, people actually putting themselves in peril with our law enforcement officials with the intent to be harmed. And I don't know if there's any, I don't know if there's any kind of a legislative concept, but you seem to be very engaged with that.
Well, I think it's
notion.
Yeah. I hadn't come here prepared with a legislative concept, but I think it's something ultimately going forward that we may want to, between the judiciary and the veterans.
Right.
I mean, because I think it envelops
you know, sort of both prongs, and
it's very much a recognized issue. I'm not sure that my brain is getting around anything.
I think it's a growing. It's a growing issue.
Madam Chair,
please.
Yeah, I think that some of the work groups, a task force of the bills that we pass regarding
something with reintegration,
the outreach, I know, but then we have women's veterans health, and I'm thinking that there's going to be things that would be able to come out there rather than us trying to do a quick and dirty, let's do something on suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that my encouragement would be that most of those task forces are charged to report their progress during the 2010 session, with, I believe, the concept or the thought that more firm sorts of legislation would be then developed before the next regular session. So I look at the short session as kind of tweaking what we have where necessary. That's my own personal perspective. But anyway, is there just four, or are there any more that?
And frankly, this could be something that grows out of the reintegration. I mean, depending on the reports that come, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean,
okay,
absolutely.
Representative Riley.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to make a motion that we actually authorize the chair and the vice chair of our committee to get a concept drafted for the and we approve that today for the reintegration process. So I'm making that a formal motion.
Okay. We have a motion before us. Let me make sure that I have it correctly, that we be authorized to draft some sort of a legislative concept that would allow for more detail to be developed around reintegration issues, depending on the work of the task force.
Correct.
Is there further discussion on that motion? With that, then, I think it would be appropriate to take a roll call vote on that motion, if we could, please.
Representative
Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Eshmal?
Aye.
Representative
Riley?
Aye.
Representative Stigler?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Freeman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Matthews?
Aye.
Chair Cowan?
Aye.
All in favor?
The motion is approved. It's all right. I don't think I need the gavel.
Well done.
Let's see, I guess we're the only one that are officially meeting.
We can, yeah. I would like to put, Madam Chair, on the record that we did not foresee that we didn't have, we're going to have a quorum here. We assumed there was only one excused absence on the Senate side, so where are the other two? And that does put us at a disadvantage, and so I want to put on the record that I think that this committee, Madam Chair, would go to President Courtney and explain the situation in case there is a concept that comes forward that we would be able to put that forward just because of the
situation. I'll let you work that out.
We will.
we most certainly will, actually.
Representative Cowan, colleagues, can I just, there are a few other things I had written down.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted
of
to mention, we were asked to do a letter to agencies about proactively participating with veterans plans, and I was hopeful that we could follow up on that. That was a piece I picked up on. Would remind everyone, if you have an opportunity to go to the October 15th meeting, I think that would be a great opportunity for this group to really get the full flavor of what the reintegration team is doing in a way that you may never have seen before. I think it's going to be a great event. Unfortunately, again, I personally will not be here, but I will have representation at this one on October 15th, but I think that would be behoove us to do that. And from my perspective, those are the only other two things I saw that I just wanted to make sure we looped back on before.
Thank you. And we, the House committee officially took action, actually. The House committee officially took action. I asked for approval to get that letter drafted. I think
you did.
The question, and I asked
whether or not
that,
I can sign
that Paul Evans would work directly with our staff to get that organized. The question is,
your signature, I
That's
think.
Right.
Should we hold for it, or should we use your electronic? Or
I do have an electronic signature on file, so I'll make sure that we get that to you. Okay.
We'll work with your staff on that.
Great.
And I'll take a look at the draft when we get it, and
okay.
we'll work from there. That would be.
I'll have access electronically to everything I need to see.
Well, we can certainly put it out there and see if you have a chance to pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, with that, I believe we are adjourned and on time. And thank you, everybody, for your hard work. And thank you.